Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
You made American Sniper the number one movie at the box office this weekend, and our next guest knows it all too well, the realities of that movie I'm talking about in real life. That's because he is one of the deadliest snipers in American history. Former Army Ranger and Sniper Sergeant Nick Irving joins me now. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here. You know, I'm looking at your resume here. You killed 33 men in less than 4 months. It's good to have you on our side, I'd say.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
When you hear the stats, though, about the film American Sniper, I mean, this is your walk. That's basically your story. When you see so many people, close to 100 million, went to go see it, they're lining up for sold-out versions of this across the nation. What does that mean to you? What does it say to you when you know America's behind this film?
I think it's a very humbling experience, or something to be a part of, that America still stands behind their troops, and it's no longer, you know, it's not just bumper sticker deep. It's actually something that America stands behind.
Yeah, it seems to be a pivotal turning point there. You know, you were in Afghanistan 3 times, Afghanistan a few times, probably too many for you, many to count. We thank you for your great service. Can you give us a glimpse into the mind of someone who does what you do? When I say those 33 kills in less than 4 months, how do you do that and then return here on, you know, safe soil as it was?
I think it's more or less a switch that needs to be turned on and off. Sometimes that switch is harder for, you know, others to turn off. PTSD is a big deal right now, but being a sniper, it's a very, you know, it's a prestigious job, but being able to stay calm, collective, and you do it for your brothers. That's the reason why I did it. I wasn't out there looking for a big number to get, or I wasn't trying to be the next Chris Kyle or anything. I just wanted to be there for the 75th Ranger Regiment.
If there's going to be another film, say, following your story, who would you want to play in?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I know who would play my dad, and I'd have to pick Denzel for that one.
Okay. You know, your book is fantastic. I want to let everybody know about that, called The Reaper, which is your nickname. Goes without saying after we talk about your numbers there. And it has a great photo cover there showing your gun, and she's got a name. It's called Dirty Diana.
Dirty Diana, yeah.
The relationship with the weapon, tell everybody about that.
Oh, pretty much. I was a big Michael Jackson fan growing up. My parents, you know, listened to Michael Jackson. But the name actually came from a deployment to Iraq. We were on some operation, and we were in a daylight firefight, and I happened to be in a striker, and my team leader at the time had an iPod, and on his iPod happened to be Dirty Diana, and we were listening to Dirty Diana during a firefight.
Well, she seems to have served you well over the time. I want to ask you about this. Michael Moore took to Twitter to really just slam what you do. He said this: my uncle killed by sniper in World War II. We were taught snipers were cowards. We'll shoot you in the back. Snipers aren't heroes, are invaders, and invaders are worse. What do you say to him?
Well, I don't think he deserves the breath that I'm about to give, but I'll just say Michael Moore, he wasn't there in Afghanistan, and the last time I checked, he's never shot anybody through the scope or with the scope of a scoped rifle. So I don't think he deserves the breath that comes out of me right now for that statement.
Don't you believe that he should have maybe turned that into somewhat of a thank you? I mean, here you are protecting everybody here, you know, the 1% protecting the 99. You go out and all those kills are really to keep us safe. Don't you think he owes you a thank you, not a shot?
I don't really care what he gives me, a thank you or not. A lot of good guys and a lot of my friends died to, you know, for his right to, I guess, freedom of speech. So I'm not really worried about what he has to say.
Well, you're a good man to take the high road there. Sergeant, it's pretty incredible to see how many people are really getting behind American Sniper, the film. Your story is incredible. The Reaper, you're known as a gentleman. You were today, of course, on Fox and Friends. And we thank you for your continued service and all that you do.
Well, thank you guys.
You got it.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of White Supremacy. Today's date, Friday, February 6th, 2015. So I have been told we are concluding Chris Kyle's American Sniper today, last session. So any final thoughts, major themes from the book, takeaways, what has stood out, the film, anything that you want to get in, this is the time to do it. Looking forward to finishing up and also processing Dr. Welsing to get to hear some of her feedback from this weekend's broadcast as well. That was Nick Irving, Black Male, The Reaper, that you heard on Fox at the beginning of the broadcast. He is supposed to have a miniseries coming out about his experience sometime in the next year or so. We can talk about that as well as some of his responses. He did a separate interview on Fox where he said he was colorblind and he didn't know anything about disparate or mistreatment of black troops during any of his three tours. With that, we will get started. Context of White Supremacy, final study session on Chris Kyle's American Sniper, Context of White Supremacy.
Rough times. I'd pushed my body as far as I could before getting operations. Now the thing that was deteriorating was even more important than my knees, my marriage. This was the roughest of a bunch of rough spots. A lot of resentment had built up between us. Ironically, we didn't actually fight all that much, but there was always a lot of tension. Each of us would put in just enough effort to be able to say we were trying and imply that the other person was not. After years of being in war zones and separated from my wife, I think in a way I'd just forgotten what it means to be in love, the responsibilities that come with it, like truly listening and sharing. That forgetting made it easier for me to push her away. At the same time, an old girlfriend happened to get in contact with me. She called the home phone first, and Taya passed the message along to me, assuming I wasn't the type of guy she had to worry about straying. I laughed off the message at first, but curiosity got the best of me. Soon my old girlfriend and I were talking and texting regularly. Taya figured out that something was up. One night I came home, and she sat me down and laid everything out, very calmly, very rationally. Or at least, as rational as you could be in that kind of situation. "We have to be able to trust each other," she said at one point. "And in the direction we're going, that's not going to work. It just won't." We had a long, heartfelt talk about that. I think we both cried. I know I did. I loved my wife. I didn't want to be separated from her. I wasn't interested in getting divorced. I know it all sounds corny as shit. Fucking seal talking about love. I'd rather get choked out 100 times than do that in public, let alone here for the whole world to see. But it was real. If I'm going to be honest, I have to put it out there. We set up a few rules that we would live by, and we both agreed to go to counseling. Taya, things just got to the point where I felt as if I was looking down into a deep pit. It wasn't just arguments over the kids. We weren't relating to each other. I could tell his mind had strayed from our marriage, from us. I remember talking to a girlfriend who'd been through an awful lot. I just unloaded. She said to me, "Well, this is what you have to do. You have to lay it all on the line. You have to tell him that you love him, and you want him to stay, but if he wants to go, he is free to do so." I took her advice. It was a hard conversation. But I knew several things in my heart. First, I knew I loved Chris. And second, and this was very important to me, I knew that he was a good dad. I'd seen him with our son and with our daughter. He had a strong sense of discipline and respect, and at the same time, he had so much fun with the kids that by the time they were done playing, they all ached from laughing. Those two things really convinced me that I had to try to keep our marriage together. From my side, I hadn't been the perfect wife either. Yes, I loved him, truly, but I'd been a real bitch at times. I had pushed him away. So both of us had to want the marriage, and we both had to come together to make it work. I'd like to say that things instantly got better from that point on, but life really isn't like that. We did talk a lot more. I started to become more focused on the marriage, more focused on my responsibilities to my family. One issue that we didn't completely resolve had to do with my enlistment and how it would fit with our family's long-term plans. My earlier reenlistment was going to be up in roughly 2 years. We had already begun discussing that. Taya made it clear that our family needed a father. My son was growing in leaps and bounds. Boys do need a strong male figure in their lives. There was no way I could disagree. But I also felt as if I had a duty to my country. I had been trained to kill. I was very good at it. I felt I had to protect my fellow SEALs and my fellow Americans. And I liked doing it a lot. But I went back and forth. It was a very difficult decision, incredibly difficult. In the end, I decided she was right. Others could do my job protecting the country, but no one could truly take my place with my family, and I had given my country a fair share. I told her I would not reenlist when the time came. I still wonder sometimes if I made the right decision. In my mind, as long as I am fit and there is a war, my country needs me. Why would I send someone in my place? A part of me felt I was acting like a coward. Serving in the teams is serving a greater good. As a civilian, I'd just be serving my own good. Being a SEAL wasn't just what I did. It became who I was. A fourth deployment. If things had worked according to normal procedures, I would have been given a long break and a long stretch of shore duty after my second deployment. But for various reasons, that didn't happen. The team promised that I'd have a break after this deployment, but that didn't work either. I wasn't real happy about it. I lost my temper talking about it, as a matter of fact, I guess more than once. Now, I like war, and I love doing my job, but it rankled me that the Navy wasn't keeping its word. With all the stress at home, an assignment that would have kept me near my family at that point would have been welcome. But I was told that the needs of the Navy came first. And, fair or not, that's the way it was. My blood pressure was still elevated. The doctors blamed it on coffee and dip. According to them, my blood pressure was as high as if I were drinking 10 cups of coffee right before the test. I was drinking coffee, but not nearly that much. They strongly urged me to cut back and stop using dip. Of course, I didn't argue with them. I didn't want to get kicked out of the SEALs or go down a road that might lead to a medical discharge. I suppose, in retrospect, some might wonder why I didn't do that, but it would have seemed like a cowardly thing to do. It would never have felt right. In the end, I was all right with being scheduled for another deployment. I still loved war. Delta Platoon. Usually, when you come home, a few guys will rotate out of the platoon. Officers will usually change out. A lot of times, the chief leaves. The LPO, lead petty officer, becomes the chief, and then someone else becomes LPO. But other than that, you stay pretty tight-knit. In our case, most of the platoon had been together for many years. Until now. Trying to spread out the experience and the team, command decided to break up Charlie Cadillac platoon and spread us out. I was assigned to Delta and put in as LPO of the platoon. I worked directly with the new chief, who happened to be one of my buds instructors. We worked out our personal selections, making assignments and sending different people off to school. Now that I was LPO, I not only had more admin crap to deal with, but couldn't be point man anymore. That hurt. I drew the line when they talked about taking my sniper rifle away. I was still a sniper, no matter what else I did in the platoon. Besides finding good point men, one of the toughest personnel decisions I had to make involved choosing a breacher. The breacher is the person who, among other things, is in charge of the explosives, who sets them and blows them, if necessary, on the DA. Once the platoon is inside, the breacher is really running things. So the group is entirely in his hands. There are a number of other important tasks in schools I haven't mentioned along the way, but which do deserve attention. Among them is the JTAC. That's the guy who gets to call in air support. It's a popular position in the teams. First of all, the job is kind of fun. You get to watch things blow up. And secondly, you're often called away for special missions, so you get a lot of action. Comms and navigation are a lot further down the list for most SEALs, but they're necessary jobs. The worst school you can send someone to has to do with intel. People hate that. They join the SEALs to kick down doors, not gather intelligence. But everyone has a role. Of course, some people like to fall out of planes and swim with the sharks. Sickos. The dispersal of talent may have helped the team in general, but as platoon LPO, I was concerned about getting the best guys over to Delta with me. The Master Chief in charge of personnel arrangements was working everything out on an organizational chart that had been set up on a big magnetic board. One afternoon while he was out, I snuck into his office and rearranged things. Suddenly, everyone who was anyone in Charlie was now assigned to Delta. My changes had been a little too drastic, and as soon as the Master Chief got back, my ear started ringing even more than normal. "Don't ever go into my office when I'm not here," he told me as soon as I reported to him. "Don't touch my board, ever." Well, truth is, I did go back. I knew he'd catch anything drastic, so I made one little switch and got Dauber into my platoon. I needed a good sniper and corpsman. The Master Chief apparently never noticed it, or at least didn't change it. I had my answer ready in case I was caught. I did it for the good of the Navy. Or at least Delta Platoon. Still recovering from knee surgery, I couldn't actually take part in a lot of the training for the first few months the platoon was together. But I kept tabs on my guys, watching them when I could. I hobbled around the land warfare sessions, observing the new guys especially. I wanted to know who I was going to war with. I was just about back into shape when I got into a pair of fights. First the one in Tennessee I mentioned earlier, where I was arrested, and then another near Fort Campbell where, as my son puts it, some guy decided to break his face on my daddy's hand. Some guy also broke my hand in the process. My platoon chief was livid. "You've been out with knee surgery, we get you back, you get arrested, now you break your hand. What the fuck?" There may have been a few other choice words thrown in there as well. They may also have continued for quite a while. Thinking back, I did seem to get into a number of fights during this training period. In my mind, at least, they weren't my fault. In that last case, I was on my way out when the idiot's girlfriend tried picking a fight with my friend, a SEAL, which was absolutely as ridiculous in real life as it must sound described here. But taken together, it was a bad pattern. It might even have been a disturbing trend. Unfortunately, I didn't recognize it at the time. Punched out. There's a postscript to the story about some guy and my broken hand. The incident happened while we were training in an army town. I knew pretty much when I punched him that I'd broken my hand, but there was no way in hell that I was going to the base hospital. If I did, they'd realize I was A, drunk, and B, fighting, and the MPs would be on my ass. Nothing makes an MP's day like busting a SEAL. So I waited until the next day. Now sober, I reported to the hospital and claimed I had broken my fist by punching out my gun before I actually cleared the door jamb. Theoretically possible, if unlikely. While I was getting treated, I saw a kid in the hospital with his jaw wired shut. Next thing I knew, some MPs came over and started questioning me. "This kid is claiming you broke his jaw," said one of them. "What the hell is he talking about?" I said, rolling my eyes. "I just came in off a training exercise. I broke my damn hand. Ask the SF guys. We were training with them." Not so coincidentally, all of the bouncers at the bar where we'd been were Army SF. They would surely back me up if it came to that. It didn't. "We thought so," said the MPs, shaking their heads. They went back over to the idiot soldier and started bitching him out for lying and wasting their time. Serves him right for getting into a fight started by his girlfriend. I came back west with a shattered bone. The guys all made fun of me for my weak genes, but the injury wasn't all that funny for me, because the doctors couldn't figure out whether they should operate or not. My finger set a little deeper in my hand, not quite where it should be. In San Diego, one of the doctors took a look and decided they might be able to fix it by pulling it and resetting it in the socket. I told him to give it a go. "You want some painkiller?" he asked. "Nah," I said. They'd done the same thing at the Army hospital back east, and it hadn't really hurt. Maybe Navy doctors pull harder. The next thing I knew, I was lying flat back on a table in the cast room. I'd passed out and pissed myself from the pain. But at least I got away without surgery. And for the record, I've since changed my fighting style to accommodate my weaker hand. Ready to go. I had to wear a cast for a few weeks, but more and more I got into the swing of things. The pace built up and we got ready to ship out. There was only one down note. We had been assigned to a western province in Iraq. From what we had heard, nothing was going on there. We tried to get transferred to Afghanistan, but we couldn't get released by the area commander. That didn't sit too well with us, certainly not with me. If I was going back to war, I wanted to be in the action, not twiddling my broken fingers in the desert. Being a SEAL, you don't want to sit around with your thumb up your ass. You want to get in the action. Still, it felt good to be getting back to war. I'd been burned out when I came home, completely overwhelmed and emotionally drained. But now I felt recharged and ready to go. I was ready to kill some more bad guys. 13. Mortality. Blind. It seemed like every dog in Sadr City was barking. I scanned the darkness through my night vision, tense as we made our way down one of the nastiest streets in Sadr City. We walked past a row of what might have been condos in a normal city. Here they were little better than rat-infested slums. It was past midnight in early April 2008, and against all common sense but under direct orders, we were walking into the center of an insurgent hellhole. Like a lot of other drab brown buildings on the street, the house we were heading to had a metal grate in front of the door. We lined up to breach it. Just then, someone appeared from behind the grate at the door and said something in Arabic. Our interpreter stepped up and told him to open up. The man inside said he didn't have a key. One of the other SEALs told him to go get it. The man disappeared, running up the stairs somewhere. Shit! Go, I yelled. Break the grate the fuck in! We rushed in and started clearing the house. The two bottom levels were empty. I raced up the stairs to the third floor and moved to the doorway of a room facing the street, leaning my back against the wall as the rest of my guys stacked to follow. As I started to take a step, the whole room blew up. By some miracle, I hadn't been hit, though I sure felt the force of the blast. "Who the fuck just threw a frag?" I yelled. Nobody. And the room itself was empty. Someone had just fired an RPG into the house. Gunfire followed. We regrouped. The Iraqi who'd been inside had clearly escaped to alert the nearby insurgents where we were. Worse, the walls in the house proved pretty flimsy, unable to stand up to the rocket grenades that were being fired at us. If we stayed here, we were going to get fried. "Out of the house! Now!" The last of my guys had just cleared out of the building when the street shook with a huge force. The insurgents had set off an IED down the street. The blast was so powerful it knocked a few of us off our feet. Ears ringing, we ran to another building nearby. But as we were fixing to enter it, all hell broke loose. We got gunfire from every direction, including above. A shot flew into my helmet. The night went black. I was blind. It was my first night in Sadr City, and it looked like it was going to be my last on Earth. Out West. Until that point, I had spent an uneventful, even boring, fourth deployment in Iraq. Delta Platoon had arrived roughly a month before, traveling out to Al-Qa'im in western Iraq near the Syrian border. Our mission was supposed to involve long-range desert patrols, but we'd spent our time building a base camp with the help of a few CBs. Not only was there no action to speak of, but the Marines who owned the base were in the process of shutting it down, meaning that we'd have to move out soon after we set it up. I have no idea what the logic was. Morale hit rock bottom when my chief risked his life early one morning. By that I mean he entered my room and shook me awake. "What the hell?" I yelled, jumping up. "Easy," said my chief. "You need to get dressed and come with me." "I just got to sleep." "You'll want to come with me. They're putting together a task unit over in Baghdad." A task unit? All right. It was like something out of the movie Groundhog Day, but in a good way. The last time this happened to me, I was in Baghdad, heading west. Now I was west and heading east. Why exactly? I wasn't sure. According to the chief, I had been chosen for the unit partly because I was qualified to be an LPO, but mostly because I was a sniper. They were pulling snipers from all over the country for the operation, though he had no details of what was being planned. He didn't even know whether I was going to a rural or urban environment. Shit, I thought. We're going to Iran. It was an open secret that the Iranians were arming and training insurgents, and in some cases even attacking Western troops themselves. There were rumors that a force was being formed to stop the infiltrators on the border. I was convoyed over to Al-Asad, the big airbase in Al-Anbar province, where our top headshed was located. There I found out we weren't going to the border, but a place much worse, Sadr City. Located on the outskirts of Baghdad, Sadr City had become even more of a snake pit since the last time I'd been with the Groms a few years before. 2 million Shiites lived there. The rabidly anti-American cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, the city had been named for his father, had been steadily building his militia, the Mahdi Army, known in Arabic as the Jaish al-Mahdi. There were other insurgents operating in the area, but the Mahdi army was by far the biggest and most powerful. With covert help from Iran, the insurgents had gathered arms and started launching mortars and rockets into Baghdad's green zone. The entire place was a viper's nest. Like Fallujah and Ramadi, there were different cliques and varying levels of expertise among the insurgents. The people here were mostly Shiites, whereas my earlier battles in Iraq had been primarily with Sunnis. But otherwise, it was a very familiar hellhole. This was all fine with me. They pulled snipers and JTACs, along with some officers and chiefs, from Teams 3 and 8 to create a special task unit. There were about 30 of us all together. In a way, it was an all-star team, with some of the best of the guys in the country. And it was very sniper-heavy, because the idea was to implement some of the tactics we'd used in Fallujah, Ramadi, and elsewhere. There was a lot of talent, but because we were drawn from all different units, we needed to spend a bit of time getting used to each other. Small differences in the way East Coast and West Coast teams typically operated could make for a big problem in a firefight. We also had a lot of personnel decisions to make, selecting point men and the like. The Army had decided to create a buffer zone to push the insurgents far enough away that their rockets would reach the green zone. One of the keys to this was erecting a wall in Sadr City, basically a huge cement fence called a T-wall that would run down a major thoroughfare about a quarter of the way into the slum. Our job was to protect the guys building that wall and take down as many bad guys as possible in the process. The boys building that wall had an insanely dangerous job. A crane would take one of the concrete sections off the back of a flatbed and haul it into place. As it was set down, a private would have to climb up and unhook it. Under fire, generally, and not just pop shots, the insurgents would use any weapon they had, from AKs to RPGs. Those army guys had serious balls. A special forces unit had already been operating in Sadr City, and they gave us some pointers and intel. We took about a week getting things all worked out and figuring out how we were going to skin this cat. Once everything was settled, we were dropped off in an Army FOB, forward operating base. At this point, we were told we were going to foot patrol into Solder City at night. A few of us argued that it didn't make much sense. The place was crawling with people who wanted to kill us, and on foot, we'd be easy targets. But someone thought it would be smart if we walked in during the middle of the night. Sneak in, they told us, and there won't be trouble. So, we did. Shot in the back. They were wrong. There I was, shot in the head and blind. Blood streamed down my face. I reached up to my scalp. I was surprised. Not only was my head still there, but it was intact. But I knew I'd been shot. Somehow I realized that my helmet, which hadn't been strapped, had been pushed back. I pulled it forward. Suddenly I could see again. A bullet had struck the helmet, but with incredible luck had ricocheted off my night vision, slamming the helmet backward, but otherwise not harming me. When I pulled it forward, I brought the scope back down in front of my eyes and could see again. I hadn't been rendered blind at all, but in the confusion, I couldn't tell what was going on. A few seconds later, I got hit in the back with a heavy round. The bullet pushed me straight to the ground. Fortunately, the round hit one of the plates in my body armor. Still, it left me dazed. Meanwhile, we were surrounded. We called to each other and organized a retreat to a marketplace we'd passed on the way in. We started laying down fire and moving together. By this time, the blocks around us looked like the worst scenes in Black Hawk Down. It seemed like every insurgent, maybe every occupant, wanted a piece of the idiot Americans who'd foolishly blundered into Solder City. We couldn't get into the building we retreated to. By now, we'd called for QRF, a quick response force, a fancy name for the cavalry. We needed backup and extraction. Help, in capital letters. A group of Army strikers came in. Strikers are heavily armed personnel carriers, and they were firing everything they had. There were plenty of targets. Upward of 100 insurgents lined the roofs on the surrounding streets trying to get us. When they saw the strikers, they changed their aim, trying to take out the Army's big personnel carriers. There, they were overmatched. It started looking like a video game. Guys were falling off the rooftops. "Motherfucker, thank you," I said aloud when the vehicles reached our building. I swear I could hear a cavalry horn somewhere in the background. They dropped their ramps, and we ran inside. "Did you see how many motherfuckers were up there?" said one of the crewmen as the vehicle sped back to the base. "No," I answered. "I was too busy shooting." "They were all over the place." The kid was stoked. "We were dropping them, and that wasn't even half of them. We were just laying it down. We thought y'all were fucking done." That made more than two of us. That night scared the shit out of me. That's when I came to the realization that I'm not superhuman. I can die. All through everything else, there had been points where I thought, I'm going to die. But I never did die. Those thoughts were fleeting. They evaporated. After a while, I started thinking, they can't kill me. They can't kill us. We're fucking undefeatable. I have a guardian angel, and I'm a SEAL, and I'm lucky, and whatever the hell it is, I cannot die. Then, all of a sudden, within 2 minutes, I was nailed twice. Motherfucker, my number is up. Building the wall. We felt happy and grateful to have been rescued. We also felt like total asses. Trying to sneak into Solder City was not going to work, and command should have known that from the start. The bad guys would always know we were there, so we would just have to make the most of it. 2 days after getting our butts kicked out of the city, we came back, this time riding in strikers. We took over a place known as the Banana Factory. This was a building 4 or 5 stories high, filled with fruit lockers and assorted factory gear, most of it wrecked by looters long before we got there. I'm not sure exactly what it had to do with bananas or what the Iraqis might have done there. All I knew at the time was that it was a good place for a sniper hide. Wanting a little more cover than I would have had on the roof, I set up on the top floor. Around 9 o'clock in the morning, I realized the number of civilians walking up and down the street had started to thin. That was always a giveaway. They spotted something, and they knew they didn't want to end up in the line of fire. A few minutes later, with the street now deserted, an Iraqi came out of a partially destroyed building. He was armed with an AK-47. When he reached the street, he ducked down, scouting in the direction of the engineers who were working down the road on the wall, apparently trying to pick one out to target. As soon as I was sure what he was up to, I aimed center mass and fired. He was 40 yards away. He fell dead. An hour later, another guy poked his head out from behind a wall on another part of the street. He glanced in the direction of the T-wall, then pulled back. It may have seemed innocent to someone else, and certainly didn't meet the ROEs, but I knew to watch more carefully. I'd seen insurgents follow this same pattern now for years. They would peek out, glance around, then disappear. I called them peekers. They peeked out to see if anyone was watching. I'm sure they knew they couldn't be shot for glancing around. I knew it too, but I also knew that if I was patient, the guy, or whoever he was spotting for, would most likely reappear. Sure enough, the fella reappeared a few moments later. He had an RPG in his hand. He knelt quickly, bringing it up to aim. I dropped him before he could fire. Then it became a waiting game. The rocket was valuable to him. Sooner or later, I knew someone would be sent to get it. I watched. It seemed like forever. Finally, a figure came down the street and scooped up the grenade launcher. It was a kid, a child. I had a clear view in my scope, but I didn't fire. I wasn't going to kill a kid, innocent or not. I'd have to wait until the savage who put him up to it showed himself on the street. Target rich. I ended up getting 7 insurgents that day, and more the next. We were in a target-rich environment. Because of the way the streets were laid out and the number of insurgents, we were getting close shots. A number were as close as 200 yards. My longest during this time was only about 880. The average was around 400. The city around us was schizophrenic. You'd have ordinary civilians going about their business, selling things, going to market, whatever. And then you'd have guys with guns trying to sneak up on the side streets and attack the soldiers putting up the wall. After we began engaging the insurgents, we would become the targets ourselves. Everyone would know where we were, and the bad guys would come out of their slug holes and try and take us down. It got to the point where I had so many kills that I stepped back to let the other guys have a few. I started giving them the best spots in the buildings we took over. Even so, I had plenty of chances to shoot. One day we took over this house, and after letting my guys choose their places, there were no more windows to fire from. So I took a sledgehammer and broke a hole in the wall. It took me quite a while to get it right. When I finally set up my place, I had about a 300-yard view. Just as I got on my gun, 3 insurgents came out right across the street, 15 yards away. I killed all of them. I rolled over and said to one of the officers who'd come over, "You want a turn?" After a few days, we figured out that the attacks were concentrating when the work crews reached an intersection. It made sense. The insurgents wanted to attack from a place where they could easily run off. We learned to bump up and watch the side streets. Then we started pounding these guys when they showed up. Fallujah was bad. Ramadi was worse. Sadr City was the worst. The overwatches would last 2 or 3 days. We'd leave for a day, recharge, then go back out. It was balls-to-the-wall firefights every time. The insurgents brought more than just their AKs to fight. We were getting rocketed every fight. We responded by calling in air cover, hellfires, and what have you. The surveillance network overhead had been greatly improved over the past several years, and the U.S. wanted to make pretty good use of it when it came to targeting predators and other assets. But in our case, the bastards were right out in the open, extremely easy to spot, and very plentiful. There were claims by the Iraqi government at one point that we were killing civilians. That was pure bullshit. While just about every battle was going down, Army intelligence analysts were intercepting insurgent cell phone communications that were given a blow-by-blow account. "They just killed so-and-so," ran one conversation. "We need more mortarmen and snipers. They killed 15 today." We had only counted 13 down in that battle. I guess we should have taken 2 out of the maybe column and put them in the definite category. Get my gun. As always, there were moments of high anxiety mixed with bizarre events and random comic relief. One day, at the end of an op, I hustled back to the Bradley with the rest of the guys. Just as I reached the vehicle, I realized my sniper rifle had been left behind. I'd put it down in one of the rooms, then forgotten to bring it with me when I'd left. Yeah, stupid. I reversed course. LT, one of my officers, was just running up. "Hey, we gotta go back," I said. "My gun's in the house." "Let's do it," said LT, following me. We turned around and raced back to the house. Meanwhile, insurgents were sweeping toward it, so close we could hear them. We cleared the courtyard, sure we would run into them. Fortunately, there was no one there. I grabbed the rifle and we raced back to the Bradleys, about 2 seconds ahead of a grenade attack. The ramp shut and the explosion sounded. "What the hell?" demanded the officer in charge as the vehicle drove off. LT smirked. "I'll explain later," he said. I'm not sure he ever did. Victory. It took about a month to get the barriers up. As the Army reached its objective, the insurgents started to give up. It was probably a combination of them realizing the wall was going to be finished whether they liked it or not, and the fact that we had killed so many of the bastards that they couldn't mount much of an attack, where 30 or 40 insurgents would gather with AKs and RPGs to fire on a single fence crew at the beginning of the op. Toward the end, the bad guys were putting together attacks with 2 or 3 men. Gradually, they faded into the slums around us. Muqtada al-Sadr, meanwhile, decided it was time for him to try and negotiate a peace with the Iraqi government. He declared a ceasefire and started talking to the government. Imagine that. Taya. People always told me I didn't really know Chris or what he was doing because he was a SEAL. I remember going to an accountant one time. He said he knew some SEALs and those guys told him no one ever really knew where they went. "My husband's on a training trip," I said. "I know where he is."
"You don't know that."
"Well, yes, I do. I just talked to him."
"But you don't really know what they're doing. They're SEALs." You can never know."
"I know my husband."
"You just can't know. They're trained to lie."
People would say that a lot. It irritated me when it was someone I didn't know well. The people I did know well respected that I might not know every detail, but I knew what I needed to know. In the villages. With things relatively calm in Sadr City, we were given a new area to target. IED makers and other insurgents had set up shop in a series of villages near Baghdad, trying to operate under the radar as they supplied weapons and manpower to fight Americans and the loyal Iraqi forces. The Mahdi army was out there, and the area was a virtual no-go zone for Americans. We had worked with members of 410 Mountain Division during much of the Sadr City battle. They were fighters. They wanted to be in the shit, and they certainly got their wish there. Now, as we bumped out into the villages outside the city, we were happy to have a chance to work with them again. They knew the area. Their snipers were especially good, and having them along improved our effectiveness. Our jobs are the same, but there are a few differences between Army and SEAL snipers. For one thing, Army snipers use spotters, which we don't, as a general rule. Their weapon set is a bit smaller than ours. But the bigger difference, at least at first, had to do with tactics and the way they were deployed. Army snipers were more used to going out in 3 or 4-man groups, which meant they couldn't stay out for very long, certainly not all night. The SEAL task unit, on the other hand, moved in heavy and locked down an area, basically looking for a fight and having the enemy provide us with one. It wasn't so much an overwatch anymore as a dare. Here we are, come and get us. And they did. Village after village, the insurgents would come and try and kill us,
we'd take them down. Typically, we'd spend at least one night and usually a few going in and extracting after sunset. In this area, we ended up going back to the same village a few times, usually taking a different house each time. We'd repeat the process until all the local bad guys were dead, or at least until they understood that attacking us was not very smart. It was surprising how many idiots you had to kill before they finally got that point. Covered with crap. There were lighter moments, but even some of those were shitty. Literally. Our point man, Tommy, was a great guy, but, as it turned out, a terrible point in a lot of ways. Or maybe I should say sometimes he was more of a duck than a point man. If there was a puddle between us and the objective, Tommy took us through it. The deeper, the better. He was always having us walk through the worst possible terrain. It got so ridiculous that finally I told him, "One more time, I'm going to whoop your ass and you're fired." On the very next mission, he found a path to a village that he was sure would be dry. I had my doubts. In fact, I pointed them out to him. "Oh, no, no," he insisted. "It's good. It's good." Once we were out in the field, we followed him across some farmland on a narrow path that led to a pipe across a path of mud. I was at the back of the group, one of the last to come across the pipe. As I stepped off, I sunk right through the mud and into crap up to my knee. The mud was actually just a thin crust atop a deep pool of sewage. It stunk even worse than a rack usually stunk. "Tommy," I yelled, "I'm going to whip your ass as soon as we get to the house." We pushed on to the house. I was still in the rear. We cleared the house, and once all the snipers were deployed, I went to find Tommy and give him the thrashing I'd promised. Tommy was already paying for his sins. When I found him downstairs, he was hooked up to an IV and puking his brains out. He had fallen into the muck and was completely covered with shit. He was sick for a day, and he smelled for a week. Every article of clothing he'd been wearing was disposed of, probably by a hazmat unit. Served him right. I spent somewhere between 2 and 3 months in the villages. I had roughly 20 confirmed kills while I was there. The action on any particular op could be fierce. It could also be slow. There was no predicting. Most of the houses we took over belonged to families who at least pretended to be neutral. I'd guess that the majority of them hated the insurgents for causing trouble and would have been even happier than we were to have the bad guys leave. But there were exceptions, and we were plenty frustrated when we couldn't do anything about it. We went into one house and saw police uniforms. We knew instantly that the owner was Mooj. The insurgents were stealing uniforms and using them to disguise themselves in attacks. Of course, he gave us a BS line about having just gotten a job as a part-time police officer, something he'd mysteriously forgotten to mention when we first interrogated him. We called it back to the army, gave them the information, and asked what to do. They had no intelligence on the guy. In the end, they decided the uniforms weren't evidence of anything. We were told to turn him loose, so we did. It gave us something to think about every time we heard of an attack by insurgents dressed as policemen over the next few weeks. Extracted. One night we entered another village and took over a house at the edge of some large open fields, including one used for soccer. We set up without a problem, surveying the village and preparing for any trouble we might face in the morning. The tempo of the ops had slowed quite a bit over the past week or two. It looked as if things were slacking down, at least for us. I started thinking about going back west and rejoining my platoon. I set up in a room on the second floor with LT. We had an army sniper and his spotter in the room next to us, and a bunch of guys on the roof. I'd taken the .338 Lapua with me, figuring that most of my shots would be on the long side since we were on the edge of the village. With the area around us quiet, I started scanning out farther, to the next village, a little more than a mile away. At some point, I saw a one-story house with someone moving on the roof. It was about 2,100 yards away. And even with the 25-power scope, I couldn't make out much more than an outline.
I studied the person, but at that point he didn't seem to have a weapon, or at least he wasn't showing it. His back was to me, so I could watch him, but he couldn't see me. I thought he was suspicious, but he wasn't doing anything dangerous, so I let him be. A little while later, an army convoy came down the road beyond the other village, heading in the direction of the cop we had just staged out of. As it got closer, the man on the roof raised a weapon to his shoulder. Now the outline was clear. He had a rocket launcher, and he was aiming it at Americans. RPG. We had no way of calling the convoy directly. To this day, I don't know exactly who they were, except that they were army. But I put my scope on him and fired, hoping to at least scare him off with a shot or maybe warn the convoy. At 2,100 yards plus a little change, it would take a lot of luck to hit him. A lot of luck. Maybe the way I jerked the trigger to the right adjusted for the wind, maybe gravity shifted and put that bullet right where it had to be. Maybe I was just the luckiest son of a bitch in Iraq. Whatever. I watched through the scope as the shot hit the Iraqi who tumbled over the wall to the ground. "Wow," I muttered. "You dumb lucky fucker," said LT. 2,100 yards. The shot amazes me even now. It was a straight-up luck shot. No way one shot should have gotten him. But it did. It was my longest confirmed kill in Iraq, even longer than that shot in Fallujah. The convoy started reacting, probably unaware of how close they'd come to getting lit up. I went back to scanning for bad guys. As the day went on, we started taking fire from AKs and rocket-propelled grenades. The conflict ratcheted up quickly. The RPGs began tearing holes in the loose concrete or adobe walls, breaking through and starting fires. We decided it was time to leave and called for extraction. "Send the RG-33s. RG-33s are big bulletproof vehicles designed to withstand IEDs and equipped with a machine gun turret on the top. We waited, continuing the firefight and ducking the insurgents' growing spray of bullets. Finally, the relief force reported that it was 500 yards away, on the other side of the soccer field. That was as close as they were getting. A pair of army Hummers blew through the village and appeared at the doors, but they couldn't take all of us. The rest of us started to run for the RG-33s. Someone threw a smoke grenade, I guess with the thought that it would cover our retreat. All it really did was make it impossible for us to see. The grenade should be used to screen movement. You run behind the smoke. In this case, we had to run through it. We ran from the house, through the cloud of smoke, ducking bullets and dodging into the open field. It was like a scene from a movie. Bullets sprayed and plinked into the dirt. The next guy to me fell. I thought he'd been hit. I stopped, but before I could grab him, he jumped to his feet. He'd only tripped. "I'm good, I'm good," he yelled. Together, we continued toward the trucks, bullets and turf flying everywhere. Finally, we reached the trucks. I jumped into the back of one of the RG-33s. As I caught my breath, bullets splashed against one of the bulletproof windows on the side, spiderweb in the glass. A few days later, I was westward bound, back to Delta Platoon. The transfer I'd asked for earlier was granted. The timing was good. Things were starting to get to me. The stress had been building. Little did I know it was going to get a lot worse, even as the fighting got a lot less. Chief Petty Officer Kyle. By now, my guys had left Al-Qaim and were at a place called Rawah, also out west near the Syrian border. Once again, they'd been put to work building barracks and the rest. I got lucky. I missed the construction work, but there wasn't much going on when I arrived, either. I was just in time for a long-range desert patrol out on the border. We drove out there for a few days, hardly seeing a person, let alone insurgents. There had been reports of smuggling across the desert, but if it was going on, it wasn't going on where we were. Meanwhile, it was hot. It was 120 degrees at least, and we were driving in Hummers that had no air conditioning. I grew up in Texas, so I know warm. This was worse, and it was constant. You couldn't get away from it. It hardly cooled off at night. It might fall to 115. Rolling down the windows meant taking a risk if there was an IED. Almost worse was the sand, which would just blow right in and cover you. I decided I preferred the sand and IED danger to the heat. I rolled down the windows. Driving, all you saw was desert. Occasionally, there would be a nomad settlement or a tiny village. We linked up with our sister platoon. Then the next day, we stopped at a Marine base. My chief went in and did some business. A little while later, he came out and found me. "Hey," he told me, grinning. "Guess what? You just made chief." I had taken the chief's exam back in the States before we deployed. In the Navy, you usually have to take a written test to get promoted, but I'd lucked out. I got a field promotion to E5 during my second deployment and made E6, thanks to a special merit program before my third deployment. Both came without taking written tests. In both cases, I had been doing a lot of extra work within the team and had made a reputation on the battlefield. Those were important factors in awarding the new ranks. That didn't fly for the chief's exam. I took the written test and barely passed. I should explain a bit more about written tests and promotions. I'm not unusually adverse or allergic to tests, at least no more than anyone else. But the tests for SEALs added an extra burden. At the time, in order to get promoted, you had to take an exam in your job area, not as a SEAL, but in whatever area you had selected before being a SEAL. In my case, that would have meant being evaluated in the intelligence area. Obviously, I wasn't in a position to know anything about that area. I was a SEAL, not an intelligence analyst. I didn't have a clue what sort of equipment and procedures Intel used to get their jobs done. Considering the accuracy of the intel we usually got, I would have guessed dartboard, maybe, or just a fine pair of dice. In order to get promoted, I would have had to study for the test, which would have involved going to a secure reading area, a special room where top-secret material can be reviewed. Of course, I would have had to do this in my spare time. There weren't any secure reading areas in Fallujah or Ramadi where I fought, and the literature in the latrines and heads wouldn't have cut it. The tests are now in the area of special operations and pertain to things SEALs actually do. The exams are incredibly detailed, but at least it has to do with our job. Becoming a chief was a little different. This test was on things SEALs should know. That hurdle cleared, my case had to be reviewed by a board and then go through further administrative review by the upper echelon. The board review process included all these chief petty officers and master chiefs sitting down and reviewing a package of my accomplishments. The package is supposed to be a long dossier of everything you've done as a SEAL, minus the bar fights. The only thing in my package was my service record, but that had not been updated since I graduated BUDS. My silver stars and bronze medals weren't even in there. I wasn't crazy about becoming a chief. I was happy where I was. As chief, I would have all sorts of administrative duties, and I wouldn't get as much action. Yes, it was more money for our family, but I wasn't thinking about that. Chief Primo was on the review board back at our base in the States. He was sitting next to one of the chiefs when they began reviewing my case. "Who the hell is this dipshit?" said the other chief when he saw my thin folder. "Who does he think he is?" "Why don't you and I go to lunch?" said Primo. He agreed. The other chief came back with a different attitude. "You owe me a Subway sandwich, fucker," Primo told me when I saw him later on. Then he told me the story. I owe him all that and more. The promotion came through, and, to be honest, being chief wasn't near as bad as I thought it would be. Truth is, I never cared all that much about rank. I never tried to be one of the highest-ranking guys, or even back in high school to be one of the students with the highest average. I'd do my homework in the truck in the morning. When they stuck me in the Honor Society, I made sure my grades dipped just enough the next semester to get kicked out. Then I brought them up again so my parents wouldn't get on me. Maybe the rank thing had to do with the fact that I preferred being a leader on the ground rather than an administrator in a back room. I didn't want to have to sit at a computer, plan everything, then tell everyone about it. I wanted to do my thing, which was being a sniper, get into combat, kill the enemy. I wanted to be the best at what I wanted to do. I think a lot of people had trouble with that attitude. They naturally thought that anyone who was good should have a very high rank. I guess I'd seen enough people with high rank who weren't good not to be swayed. Too much thinking. On the road again. Willie Nelson cranked through the speaker system of our Hummer as we set out for our base the next day. Music was about the only diversion we had out here, outside of the occasional stop in a village to talk to the locals. Besides the old-school country my buddy behind the wheel preferred, I listened to a bit of Toby Keith and Slipknot, country and heavy metal vying for attention. I'm a big believer in the psychological impact of music. I've seen it work on the battlefield. If you're going into combat, you want to be pumped up. You don't want to be stupid crazy, but you do want to be psyched. Music can help take the fear away. We'd listen to Papa Roach, Dope, Drowning Pool, anything that amped us up. They're all in heavy rotation on my workout mix now. But nothing could amp me up on the way back to base. It was a long, hot ride. Even though I'd just gotten some good news about my promotion, I was in a dark mood, bored on the one hand and tense on the other. Back at base, things were incredibly slow. Nothing was going on, and it started to get to me. As long as I had been in action, the idea of my being vulnerable, being mortal, had been something I could push away. There was too much going on to worry about it. Or rather, I had so much else to do, I didn't really focus on it. But now, it was practically all I could think of. I had time to relax, but I couldn't. Instead, I'd lie on my bed thinking about everything I'd been through, getting shot especially. I relived the gunshot every time I lay down to rest. My heart thumped hard in my chest, probably a lot harder than it had that night in Solder City. Things seemed to go downhill in the few days after we got back from our border patrol. I couldn't sleep. I felt very jumpy, extremely jumpy, and my blood pressure shot up again, even higher than before. I felt like I was going to explode. Physically, I was beat up. 4 long combat deployments had taken their toll. My knees felt better, but my back hurt, my ankle hurt, my hearing was screwed up, my ears rang, my neck had been injured, my ribs cracked. My fingers and knuckles had been broken. I had floaters and decreased vision in my right eye. There were dozens of deep bruises and an assortment of aches and pains. I was a doctor's wet dream. But the thing that really bothered me was my blood pressure. I sweated buckets and my hands would even shake. My face, pretty white to begin with, became pale. The more I tried to relax, the worse things got. It was as if my body had started to vibrate. And thinking about it only made it buzz more. Imagine climbing a tall ladder out over a river 1,000 miles up, and there you're struck by lightning. Your body becomes electric, but you're still alive. In fact, you're not only aware of everything that's happening, but you know you can deal with it. You know what you have to do to get down. So you do. You climb down. But when you're back on the ground, the electricity won't go away. You try to find a way to discharge the electricity, to ground yourself, but you can't find the damn lightning rod to take the electricity away. Unable to eat or sleep, I finally went to the docs and told them to check me out. They took a look at me and asked if I wanted medication. Not really, I told them, but I did take the meds. They also suggested that since the mission tempo was practically non-existent and we were only a few weeks from going home anyway, it made sense for me to go home. Not knowing what else to do, I agreed. 14. Home and out. Ducking out. It was late August when I left. As usual, it was almost surreal. One day I was in the war. The next I was home. I felt bad about leaving. I didn't want to tell anyone about the blood pressure or anything else. I kept it to myself as best I could. To be honest, it felt a little like I was ducking out on my boys, running away because my heart was pounding funny or whatever the hell it was doing. Nothing that I had accomplished earlier could erase the feeling that I was letting my boys down. I know it doesn't make sense. I know I had accomplished a huge amount. I needed a rest, but I felt I shouldn't take one. I thought I should be stronger than was possible. To top things off, some of the medication apparently didn't agree with me. Trying to help me sleep, a doctor back home in San Diego prescribed a sleeping pill. It put me out, so much so that when I really woke up, I was on base with no recollection of working out at home and driving myself to base. Tay had told me about my workout, and I knew I had driven to work because my truck was there. I never took that one again. It was nasty. Taya, it's taken me years to get my head around some of this stuff. On the surface, Chris wants to just go and have a good time. When people really need him, though, when lives are on the line, he is the most dependable guy. He's got a situational sense of responsibility and caring. I saw this in his promotions in the military. He didn't care. He didn't want the responsibility of the higher rank, even though it would mean providing better for his family. And yet if a job needed to be done, he was there. He will always rise to the challenge, and he's prepared because he's been thinking about it. It was a real dichotomy, and I don't even think a lot of people understood it. It was even hard for me to reconcile at times. Protecting people. While I was home, I got involved in a fairly interesting scientific program relating to stress and combat situations. It used virtual reality to test what sorts of effects battle has on your body. In my case, specifically, they monitored my blood pressure, or at least that was the one measurement that really interested me. I wore a headpiece and special gloves while viewing a simulation. It was basically a video game, but it was still pretty cool. Well, in the simulations, my blood pressure and heart rate would start out steady. Then, once we got into a firefight, they would drop. I would just sit there and do everything I had to do, real comfortable. As soon as it was over and things were peaceful, my heart rate would just zoom. Interesting. The scientists and doctors running the experiment believe that during the heat of the battle, my training would take over and would somehow relax me. They were really intrigued because apparently they hadn't seen that before. Of course, I'd lived it every day in Iraq. There was one simulation that left a deep impression on me. In this one, a Marine was shot, and he went down screaming. He'd been gut shot. As I watched that scene, my blood pressure spiked even higher than it had been. I didn't need a scientist or a doctor to tell me what that was about. I could just about feel that kid dying on my chest in Fallujah again. People tell me I saved hundreds and hundreds of people, but I have to tell you, it's not the people you saved that you remember. It's the ones you couldn't save. Those are the ones you talk about. Those are the faces and situations that stay with you forever. In or out? My enlistment was coming to an end. The Navy kept trying to entice me to stay, making different offers. Handle training, work in England, anything I wanted just so I would stay in the Navy. Even though I had told Taya I wouldn't reenlist, I wasn't ready to quit. I wanted to go back to the war. I felt I'd been cheated on my last deployment. I struggled trying to decide what to do. Some days I was through with the Navy, other days I was ready to tell my wife the hell with it and reenlist. We talked about it a lot. Taya, I told Chris that both our kids needed him, especially at that particular time, our son. If he wasn't going to be there, then I would move closer to my father so at least he would grow up with a strong grandfather very close to him. I didn't want to do that at all. And Chris really loved us all. He really wanted to have and nurture a strong family. Part of it came down to the conflict we'd always had. Where were our priorities? God, family, country, my version, or God, country, family, Chris's? To my mind, Chris had already given his country so much, a tremendous amount. The previous 10 years had been filled with constant war. Heavy combat deployments were combined with extensive training workups that kept him away from home. It was more heavy action and absence than any other SEAL I knew of. It was time to give his family some of himself. But, as always, I couldn't make the decision for him. The Navy suggested that they could send me to Texas as a recruiter. That sounded pretty good, since the job would allow me to have regular hours and come home at night. It looked to me like a possible compromise. "You have to give me a little time to work this out," said the Master Chief I was dealing with. "This isn't the sort of thing we can do overnight." I agreed to extend my enlistment a month while he worked on it. I waited and waited. No orders came. "It's coming, it's coming," he said. "You have to extend again." So I did. A few more weeks passed. We were almost through October by now, and no orders came through. So I called him up and asked what the hell was going on. "It's a catch-22, he explained. "They want to give it to you, but it's a 3-year billet. You don't have any time." In other words, they wanted me to enlist first. Then they would give me the job. But there were no guarantees, no contract. I'd been there before. I finally told them, "Thanks, but no thanks. I'm getting out." Taya. "He always says, I feel like a quitter. I think he's done his job, but I know that's how he feels. He thinks if there are people out there fighting, it should be him. And a lot of other SEALs feel that way about themselves as well, but I believe not one of them would blame him for getting out."
Alrighty, let's see if... Okay, we should be rolling. Context of white supremacy. Again, it did not have the same quality, as I mentioned at the beginning, for folks who might have tuned in late. Didn't have the same audio quality because for whatever reason, the switchboard was not permitting me to play any audio clips out of my control. That is white people's technology, but I hope folks were able to listen live and didn't have too much trouble. For the people who listen to the archive, it should not matter at all. Like, it should be crystal clear for folks in the archives. The only people in the live listening audience would have had that difficulty. And I was kind of keeping an eye on my email and Facebook and what have you. I didn't see folks griping too much. So one person, I had to leave my change my sound configuration, which resulted in folks being able to hear if I shifted or was name calling or anything else. So I tried to be as quiet as possible. I didn't see too many disruptions in my email. That being said, we will get our final audio clip in. We're almost at the conclusion of the text. Next audio segment will wrap us up. Now, the number to dial, 760-569-7676. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. And for folks that are following along, we'll be picking up. We are in chapter 14, which is the last chapter in the book. Chapter 14, the subheading is Ryan Gets Married. That's where we'll be starting back for the next audio segment. Ryan Gets Married. For me, it's on page 614. The number again for folks who would like to call in, 760-569-7676. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use the phone, you can use the free Flash phone. Works anywhere in the world. The address that you can use to access it is tiny.tiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. The address again is tiny.tiny.cc /1race. And that is the number one. Once you put in the address, click the link on the left side of the page. It will say flash phone. Click that. It will open a small window on your screen. The top line, it is a drop down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 760-569-7676. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code is 564-943. The final line, it will ask for a name. Just, you know, you can press random keys, use a nickname. If you're comfortable with your real name, that's fine too. Once you get all that done, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the page, to the program, excuse me, and you should be able to hear us live. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *6. Once you do that, you'll get the audio prompt to press 1. I'll see your hand, and we will get you on the line. Thanks for the folks being patient. Hopefully, white people's technology will do better so we don't have continued difficulties. Anywho, everybody who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Hello, good night. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, cool beans. Good night to all. I listened to the audio, and what you guys always say, white people kill for fun. That was like a predominant theme in the book. And, like, white supremacy is a game for white people. At one point, he was talking about he had so many kills that he had to give other soldiers time so they could get their kills up also. He said, his heart rate was racing when there was peace, when nothing was going on. He becomes anxious when there's nothing going on, there's no violence going on, and it calms down when he's in like a fighting mode. The guy with the he went into a house and he said he saw some police uniforms, and just by him seeing the police uniforms, he's saying the guy is an insurgent. That just reminds me of like what the police do right now, where they just see just a simple stuff and just draw these grandiose conclusions from the things that they see. He spoke about some Iraqi in a building that was 2,100, I don't know if it's yards or feet, but it was really, really far away. He said he wasn't sure. It was hard to make out the image, but he was pretty sure that it was an RPG that person had in his hand. Once again, just making stuff up. And he said that when he shot the person, it was like gravity shifted. And he said that also early in the book when he said that he had shot somebody, and it was like God kissed the bullet. So I find that theme in the book also. And yeah, that's all I have for now. Sorry if I ranted. That's it.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How you doing, Gus? How's everybody on the line? I'm Thomas Smith from New York. Had a few observations. I made that same observation, the gentleman who just called me, when he's making so many kills, he just wanted to give someone else a chance. And he even told them where to set up shooters so they could get more the maximum amount of kills. But I don't think that it's a game to white people. I think they're dead serious. They're dead serious. While I was listening, I looked up Sada City. Just Google Sada City. It's S-A-D-R. And look at what white people did to this city and these poor people there. I mean, they got a lake outside the city that is blood red. And I would imagine that's real blood. It was first discovered in 2007 on Google Earth. I know white people don't miss an observation or a chance to go research and discover something. So if there was a red lake there before, we would have heard about it. And also, the people who live inside the city, you know, they didn't look like the typical Arabs. They looked a little bit more Dravidian, like, you know, the darker Indian type. And I thought it was funny because he made a reference to Black Hawk Down. It was like Black Hawk Down there. And I was thinking maybe because these people were darker. It was a part, I can't really remember, you know, he was talking about how they have to count the fatalities, and he was sure, 100% sure he didn't kill any civilians. And I'm like, if the soldiers got to count the fatalities, then I'm quite sure he killed a whole bunch of civilians. And they just called them insurgents. They're riding through the desert, just playing Willie Nelson on the road again. I mean, I could just imagine it, man. Oh, man. My line of the book, he said, my face was already white, but it turned pale. Jesus Christ. I mean, he was whiter than white, I guess. He turned down promotions that would have brought more money and allowed him to support his family better because he wanted to stay in the action. He didn't want no desk job. He didn't want to be in the background calling the shots. He wanted to be taking them. The last thing is, he was had a reference, like, it was like some type of beef between the soldiers from the eastern part, I guess, and the soldiers from the western part. He made it sound like it was like a rap war or something, you know, like they, you know, argue about how they're going to go in and these people went in that way. And lastly, I think, in my opinion, and, you know, it didn't really point it out in the text, but just knowing how women are and how they think. And here this guy is never around, never home. He didn't care when your baby was born. He's not taking jobs to get more money to come into the house. You know, I would bet she was cheating on him that whole time, you know, and I don't know. I just have this funny feeling. I looked at her on the internet, and, you know, I mean, she just seems real to me. I didn't get any sympathy or anything from you know, what I saw of her in her little interview. Seemed like she was pretty happy and, you know, moved on in her life. It was over. Thank God. That's the impression I got from the interview that I watched. And I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. Henry Ford here. Going back to, in my book, page 370, they're talking about reenlistment and the fact that his family needed him as a father. And I guess he was torn between going back or staying and being a father for his family. So he said he found it incredibly difficult to decide. Then at the bottom of the page, he said that he had given my country my fair share. So he mentions the word fair a lot. I thought it was interesting that Talia called herself a bitch when she was talking about describing the home life that they had. and it seemed out of context, you know, for a female to refer to herself, you know, as being bitchy at times. Also, when he broke his hand in a fight, and although coincidentally, both of them ended up in the hospital at the same time, and he's such an incredible liar that he talks his way out of it, and he says that being a SEAL, you don't want to sit around with your thumb up your ass. You want to get into the action. So there's another reference to the genitals or the anal area. At one part of the book, he said he wasn't didn't consider himself a badass, but then he made reference to his chief risked his life early one morning when he entered his room and shook him awake. So we know that the guy has issues and that he's pathological, and that there is some contradiction here between who he believes he is. And he mentioned that the army was building the wall and being shot at the same time while they were unhooking sections of the wall. And he said the army guys had serious balls. And as if performing a dangerous task that they had been ordered to do, that they had a choice in doing it at all. Because when you're given an order, whether it's dangerous or not, you have to do it. It seems every chance the book gets, they mention weapons. Seem to mention AK-47s a lot and RPGs, which, you know, they make a reference to Soviet-made weapons, but in reality, the Iraqis had weapons that the U.S. had supplied to Iraq, to Saddam Hussein, trying to start a conflict between Iran and Iraq. So some of those IEDs probably could have been Claibornes. A lot of American weaponry was used in Iraq. Chris talked about hearing communications, you know, from the Iraqis that 15 men was killed and they had only counted 13 in battle. And he was making reference to make it seem like a video game. He didn't know whether the two should have been in the maybe column or in the definite category of definite kills. So he was minimizing human life, turned it into a game. And who forgets their rifle in a war? I mean, I'm getting suspicious about some of these stories because leaving your gun behind, I have a hard time with that. You're in a war, you forget your gun. Also, last but not least, in the Navy, a person would have to take a test or an exam to get a promotion. He got E5 and E6 without taking a test or exam. It just goes to show how the system works in some people's favor, especially if you're white and you're in a system of white supremacy. I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking the call.
Good evening, everyone. It's Carmel from Texas. I'll pick up where Mr. Demery Four left off. I get the distinct impression he's not the sharpest tool in the shed. You know, he's just always saying, I love action so much, I love action so much. He reminds me so much of these white boys here in Texas. And I am just now understanding that that part of their code is never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, let the black person know that they understand better than you do. and that they are performing better than you do, and that they are more capable than you are. I think that's maybe at the top of the white code, because this boy is not smart. He just doesn't strike me as smart at all. Just a lot of excuses for why I'm not going to read, I can't take a test, I can't sit down and study this, I can't go over there and study that. It's too many excuses. And also, you know, he doesn't say anything. He says that, oh, his blood pressure, I am sure that is those anabolic steroids he was taking. I'm sure he was taking drugs. That's what they do. They want to have performance-enhancing things going on while they're over there, and that was probably his blood pressure problem. And it was probably his hyper-aggression problem, you know, throwing his fist at someone else's face. I really think that was probably steroids, and he probably had amphetamines on board too, which is why he couldn't sleep. And also another bit of evidence to that is when he did go in, because he wasn't sleeping, because he was probably taking amphetamines, maybe Adderall or something like that. He did that nighttime wakefulness that those drugs give you, you know, some of those newer sleep medications. And he went straight to the gym. So, you know, he's probably really focused on that performing enhancing stuff. And also they say what happens in the military now is that in the PX they have a whole section that is unlike the U.S. And they call them dietary supplements. So, you know, you can just go over there and get some dextromethorphan or whatever you want. And it reminded me, another thing he was misrepresenting himself about, he said, well, you know, I went to the doctor to, what is he getting, his handset? He says, I didn't take any pain medication, and I passed out from the pain. You know, I think he's just a wussy medical guy. You know, the last time he said he went to the doctor and he was going to aspirate some fluid out of a cyst in his neck, and he came toward him with the needle, and all of a sudden he said, I had a seizure. He dropped. He passed out. And he says, oh, you know, I had a seizure, and my buddy convinced the doctor not to put it on my medical record that I had this seizure, that I never had another seizure again in my life. He just saw the needle, and he passed out. I don't think he had a seizure at all. And this is the last thing, is that, you know, sometimes when I was younger and the children would come out and they would destroy the house every time they came out, you know, I just got to the point where I accepted that they came to destroy. You know, he was having that paradoxical reaction to the war games. You know, he became calmer when he was destroying than he was when he wasn't destroying. Maybe that's what he is. Maybe he comes to destroy. Maybe he's just here to destroy. It's his baseline. All right, I'll mute my line.
Anybody else who had a hand up who wanted to make sure they got comments in on the first audio clip? Local. We should have time left in case anyone didn't share, or if you didn't get a hand up yet, if you have anything that you want to get in, you should have time for that as well. I will start. This remains current with some of the things that were reported this week. Number one, the state of Texas, they made February 2nd Chris Kyle Day. That was announced, I guess, Tuesday or maybe Monday, Tuesday of this week, that was the new push. And there's also a petition that is gaining momentum to have Chris Kyle awarded the Medal of Honor posthumously. That also came out this week. Former Governor Jesse Ventura, Scruffface, from the text. I think last week we covered the section where the fictitious incident of Kyle slugging former Governor Ventura, since the lawsuit decided that this probably didn't happen, that this is a fictitious incident. He was doing an interview broadcast, I think with Fox. I might be an error on that, but I think it was with one of the Fox affiliates. But basically, he said that he compared Chris Kyle celebrating killing all these people. He compared it to Nazi Germany. And the metaphor that he laid out was that for a Nazi, a member of the Third Reich during World War II, when they're going and invading France and Poland and all these other areas, and killing people, right? They got their body count the same way as Chris Kyle and celebrating that he would have been celebrated in Nazi Germany, like right on. You know, he killed 50 Frenchmen or Poles or whomever, you know, whoever they're slaughtering and taking out in the name of the Third Reich. He said it is the same thing, going and celebrating, killing savages when you're invading a quote unquote sovereign nation. And celebrating and making a film about all this, it's the exact same thing. And I believe Seth Rogen created some controversy by making a similar analogy and saying that this film reminded him of the scene in Inglourious Basterds, which is a Quentin Tarantino production, where the Nazis are celebrating this white killer who's a sniper, who killed something. He's bragging like he killed 100 people in one day and then came back and killed like 200 people the next day, and they make a movie about him killing all these people. He said it reminded him of that. So it's these are white people coming out and making the same comparison, which I think is absolutely correct. The book and the film. Also this week, I know Nick Irving, I think some folks had mentioned him before. He's done several interviews. He's not just the most recent one that I saw from the past 7 days, but he's done several. He's a black male. He's a U.S. Navy SEAL, and he was also a sniper. And he also has a book out about his experience as a sniper, not nearly as popular as Chris Kyle's American Sniper, which he didn't even write. I think Bruce Fine had said he's out on the Chitlin circuit trying to drum up interest, although I would say that, at least from the report that I saw this week, he's had a mild breakthrough. He's supposed to be getting a TV miniseries based on his book and his experiences as a Navy SEAL and a sniper. But the more recent interview that I saw he did on Fox News is about 10 minutes, and they asked him about racism within the Navy. And he said, as a black male, he said that he was colorblind and that he was not aware of any mistreatment of black troops, that he saw a lot of white people die, and he didn't think there was any truth to reports that a disproportionate amount of the casualties, fatalities, and just harmful treatment that soldiers were being subjected to, that a disproportionate amount of that was being doled out to black and non-white troops. He said that that was not in accordance with what he had seen, and he didn't think such a thing was true. But the overriding theme that he stated repeatedly was that he is colorblind, that I don't go around looking to see a black person or a white person or any of that. These are just my brothers in arms, and we're here to support, protect, and defend. That was the line that he gave, which I'm sure the white folks at Fox, you know, standing ovation, right on. Excellent job. But that's something folks can kind of look out for, to see what type of response, if they go ahead and complete this movie miniseries, to see how people respond, what network it's on. Does it get the same type of hoopla as American Sniper, which I seriously doubt. Things from the text, I definitely agree with a lot of the commentary that folks shared this segment. And again, I can only emphasize, I don't know if everybody that's listening, I don't know if everybody saw the movie. I did post a link that the person shared so you can watch it online. I'm not, you know, saying pay for it, but these are like two separate entities. There's so much, you know, detail. And I mean, that's the case for most films, right? That you can't include everything that's in the book. But in my opinion, the film leaves out so much of the pathology of Chris Kyle. It really does a job in trying to sanitize his image so that you don't get that this guy is just, you know, some drunkard who likes to go out to taverns and brawl and fight and flip over cars and fight enforcement officers and in my opinion, boast about
breaking his hand, slugging somebody and punching them in the face where you could have killed someone, that he brags about this sort of thing, that he's cheating on his wife. I think he probably minimized that. He was probably cheating on his wife, both when he was back home and, when he was overseas. I mean, just all of that gets, in the film I'm talking about, just is totally sanitized, minimized. It's, in my opinion, it's two separate entities, for people who go see the film and haven't read the book. Or don't really know as much about, you know, what is written in the text. I think you'll come away with a totally different, experience. That being said, I also, thought the anal references, that folks pointed out, most likely him taking all kinds of drugs. I totally agree, with that. Not just him, that standard operating procedure for white troops in whatever capacity they happen to be serving, whether soldiers, professors, whatever, that's just standard operating, procedure for the white team. Also thought this was another segment this week where I felt Taya's influence, because if you notice when her parts come up, it'll be quick. Like, it might focus about whatever problems they're having at home and, you know, I don't want you to enlist again, and our marriage is struggling and getting counseling. It's really like, that's just fluff. Like, okay, we'll throw in 5 cents. Like, yeah, life is tough. Marriage. Okay. Back to killing these saps. Like, I mean, that's really the way it feels to me. I think I pointed that out, the transitions to when they bring in, some of her narrative and she gets to tell her side. It just seems like it's such a gross, discontinuity, in the text, and that this is really just an interruption from the important thing, which is killing, destroying, maiming, laughing about the slaughter of non-white people. Those are some of the main things that, stuck out in the text this week. I will pause. I guess one to make sure, there aren't any. Oh, okay. We got some other folks that dialed in. The people that got a hand up more recently, so you haven't got an opportunity to share yet, your line should also be open. Did you have comments you want to get in as well?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to comment on his, you know, promotions. I don't recall. It seems like earlier on when he was trying to go to college, he struggled. And suddenly he has this high grade point average. And it sounds like to me that they moved him up, you know, without really him meeting the qualifications, you know. And I know they do this a lot. You know, I've seen it, you know, many, many times where, you know, if they want to promote a white person, they figure out a way to do it. Whether it's a black person, if you come in there and you got the experience and they say they want the education, if you come in with the education, they want the experience. And if you come in with both, well, a white person was a better fit, all kinds of little nonsense. So I just kind of find it hard to believe. And he said he passed that test the first time. I kind of find that hard to believe, too, because I don't remember him, you know, because I can't even remember what it was. If he was in junior college or what, but it wasn't something that he really cared about. He even stated it again that he didn't care about the grades. So how did he get a high grade point average? You know, it's just very, you know, another thing to make him into a hero when he doesn't really deserve it. I'll mute my line.
Did, we miss anybody? Anybody have a hand up who didn't get an opportunity to share? Okie dokie. Yeah, I would say keep that in mind as well. In fact, another great comparison for Rebecca Skloot, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. All of the time and detail that they spend on how messed up the whole family is, Zakaria and folks going to jail, Crazy Joe, as they call him in the book, and his prison letters and all that. In my opinion, you don't get nearly the same. I mean, it's a totally different world, the film. But even in the book, his deviant pathology is not presented in the same manner as what I felt we got from The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's like, oh, he's just having a little fun. I mean, it's not presented as this guy is an alcoholic, psychopathic racial personality, Dr. Bobby E. Wright, a cheat, a drunkard, a liar. It's not given. I mean,
at all. It's just, oh, he's, you know, just having a little fun, blowing off a little steam, all the stress that he's under from defending the country and protecting our rights for free speech to even do a nutty show like this and critique. It's just not that at all. And I haven't read Nick Irving's book, so, you know, maybe I'm wrong. But I just can't imagine them putting him out on television and doing a film about him in the same way if he was a drunkard who was fighting police officers, no less, and firefighters, and flipping over cars and being arrested and going to jail and doing drugs and cheating on his wife. I just cannot imagine a black person getting the same treatment as this white psychopath. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some folks read The Reaper and, you know, we'll see what that looks like. Sorry about that. I was trying to find the other folks that dialed in. Other folks who happen to be on the line who just got a hand up, do you have any comments you wanted to get in as well?
Hi. On the movie, they showed him at the bar like one time, and they try to picture him as the family guy. Then when you go through the book reading, you know, he's far from that. He's just murderer. That's all he is. He's murder, murder, murder. And, you know, so that's how they do it. I took some notes, though, on, if you remember, they said he said he was in the Honor Society, or he was president of the Honor Society, and he brought his grades down because he didn't want to be in it, and then he bought him back up because, you know, he didn't want his mom and dad on him. I don't believe it. I think it's a lot of lies. And the sleeping pills, you know, you drove to the gym, you forgot, you know, and that does happen. I heard about those sleeping pills. I wouldn't mess with them at all. But, you know, what if he forgot? He could have hurt somebody. Maybe he forgot. Did he forget? Maybe he went and killed somebody, and then he might have blanked that out off of these sleeping pills, the type of murderer he is. And let me see, what other notes did I take? I also wanted to know, I wonder how much would Taya get? Because he was a SEAL, and then now he's dead, and then they might give him the Medal of Honor. So I wonder how much does a widow get for, you know, when their SEAL husband or spouse dies. And that was just a couple notes that I took. But it's nonsense. But I like listening to it, though. I mean, it's eye-opening. But it's, you know, basic European behavior to me.
Agreed. Just on Taya Kyle, really quick as well. She did an interview this week. She was on Anderson Cooper, speaking of Pale. And she was with Chris Kyle's brother. And they were talking about the film. And saying, I mean, just this sort of thing, for me, the Medal of Honor and these sort of interviews, like, they really, for me, just drive it home that I think a lot of this is just malarkey that they have made up. In my view, racists are very, very good at just making up a narrative, and just the more you can add on, the better. Like, compound and compound and compound. What are the infamous quote of Adolf Hitler is, the bigger the lie, the more people believe it. I feel like that definitely could be happening here with the big blockbuster film, and then the Medal of Honor, and the funeral service at Texas Stadium, and I mean, it's just wild. It's a lot for me to believe that all this went down, as they say. At any rate, she was on Anderson Cooper's show, and they asked her about PTSD, and the trial is coming up too. I guess that's something, if folks want to continue to follow, kind of what happens with the white killer of Chris Kyle and the other male that was present, Eddie Rout, that's his name. His trial is about to start, and so they were asking her what she thought about Routh's defense that he has PTSD. And she was just, you know, disgusted at the suggestion that this guy had any sort of mental problem, and that resulted in him killing her husband, that, you know, this guy was just evil. And she emphasized that she knew a lot of veterans who had PTSD and they were not killers. Yes, they, you know, would have difficulties and they might be a little moody at times and what have you. But, you know, it does not turn you into a killer having this sort of post-combat stress. And she emphasized that she thought that was a really lame excuse. And even disrespectful to veterans who legitimately have PTSD. Her guest brother-in-law, he said that it made him furious for this guy to try to hide behind that sort of excuse. But that was this week also, their exchange. Anybody else, any thoughts they want to get in before we get to the second and final audio segment?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I think I recall a few years back, there was just this horrible episode of all these soldiers that were, you know, like killing themselves, killing their wives, you know, getting in all kinds of trouble because of PTSD. Now, I could probably look it up again, but I think that's what happened. I think there's still a very high suicide rate. So I don't know what she's talking about that. And what was he doing when he was helping this guy? It was because he was having some severe, you know, emotional issues. So I didn't see the interview, but I don't think she's correct in what she said. I will mute my line.
Well, I think that a man who's getting ready to be on trial for killing Chris Kyle, he was saying to his sister when he drove over to her place, she said that he said that being with them was just like, he said, he felt like he was in hell. It was like being with the devil. So, and that's why he shot him.
Wow. Pay attention to the trial. When that comes up, we'll probably splice in a few news clips once it gets rolling this year. But so this is Chris Kyle's wife, Taya. She also said that she felt that Chris did not have enough information about the severity of Eddie Routh's mental problems before they went out to the gun range. And she also felt that that was a major problem, that he should have been more informed about, you know, this guy could be potentially dangerous to be hanging out and going to the gun range. I think they said his parents had already removed all of the guns and weapons from his residence. Eddie Routh, I'm talking about, had removed all the weapons because they were fearful that he would hurt himself or hurt someone else. He had been making some suicidal ideations before all of this transpired anyway. So, again, I'm sure a lot of this will come out during the trial. Anything else? Anything else before we get to the second audio clip?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I just wanted to mention one last thing. Just like one of the other male callers mentioned that, when he was talking about the assortment of aches and pains that he had and how his blood pressure was high, he made reference to his face being pretty white, and then it began to become pale. So, whiter than white. And then Taya said that he had a situational sense of responsibility and caring after he had decided to go back to war rather than being a father with the family. I mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I agree with a previous caller who mentioned him, who suspects that this guy was a heavy HGH or, you know, some kind of steroid user because of these injuries. Once you induce yourself with those chemicals that come from steroids, the body actually starts breaking down. It screws up your decision making ability, and you get hype, you get hyper, He reminds me of Lyle Alzado, the former NFL player who he ended up, I believe, dying of brain cancer. But he said it was, he admitted that it was due to heavy steroid use. And he had an attitude similar to what I'm hearing about Killer Kyle. You know, very aggressive. I mean, this white male even had the nerve to jump in the ring with Muhammad Ali one time. You know, he started smelling himself so much and thinking that he was invincible. And this guy sounds very much the same. And with the advent of his body breaking down, like it was described in the book, those are telltale signs. The attitude that he had, you know, always itching for a fight. That's why he feels so comfortable in combat, because that's all it is a lot of fighting. And so that's just what I wanted to allude to, based on what I've been hearing. Thank you.
We have one more person who had a hand up who didn't get to share. If you can get your commentary in before we get to the second audio segment.
Gus, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
What you just read about what the white said about Chris Kyle, the guy killed Chris Kyle, is a she was trying to say that he did not have a mental disorder, or his mental disorder was not a factor.
The latter, she did not accept him having PTSD or any other mental problems as an excuse for killing her husband.
He was military also, wasn't he?
Yes, sir.
Do we know how many people he is supposed to have killed?
I do not know. I do not know his comment.
Because I guess what I was saying, if his kill number was less than hers, we know he killed one, Chris Kyle. So,
two.
Or allegedly, according to them.
He's allegedly shot two people, yeah.
Okay, but we also have Chris Kyle claiming to have killed, what, hundreds or something? So it's a mental disorder amongst Europeans to only kill a couple people, and it's normal, according to her, to kill as many as Chris Kyle can. That's my observation.
Yeah, it's. I think I linked it last week, but the Washington Post, they did a report about Mr. Routh specifically, and they said that, I pointed it out because it's the same thing that Chris Kyle said, that both of them enjoyed violence and combat before they were in the military, when they were children. They both loved fighting. It's in the book, and some of Mr. Routh's family members, they said that in the report that's on the Washington Post. So, if anything, it just, for me, just further reinforces, as we've said all along, white people kill for fun. And that is a major aspect of why the book, the film, is so popular, that this is, you know, the religion of white supremacy, which demands violence, constant violence against non-white people. But with that, we will wrap and get to the second audio segment. If you didn't get to share, if you had things you wanted to make sure you got in, just, you know, take notes. We should have time once the second audio segment wraps up. And you can get your concluding thoughts in about the book or any other aspects of the film, the book, Mr. Routh, anything related. If you want to get those in before we wrap up again, we are in the final chapter, chapter 14.
Okay, leave me muted. You can mute my line.
Oh, yes. The subheading for chapter 14 is Ryan Gets Married. That's where we are. For me, that is page 614. But it's definitely chapter 14, Ryan Gets Married. Take notes. Looking to wrap up. Enjoyed the commentary. Context of White Supremacy, Mr. Chris Kyle, American Sniper. We'll see if the audio works. All righty. So we'll have to do it the other way. I will try to be as quiet as possible. All right. Let's see.
Ryan Gets Married. Ryan and I remained close after he returned to the States. In fact, our friendship grew even stronger, which I wouldn't have thought possible. I felt drawn to him by his tremendous spirit. He'd been a warrior in combat. Now he was an even greater warrior in life. You never completely forgot that he was blind, but you also never ever got the impression that his disability defined him. He had to get a prosthetic eye made because of his wounds. According to LT, who went with him to pick it up, he actually had two,
One was a regular eye, and the other had a golden seal trident where the iris ordinarily would be. Once a seal, always a seal. I'd been with Ryan a lot before he got hurt. A lot of the guys on the team had a wicked sense of humor, but Ryan was in a class by himself. He'd get you in stitches. He wasn't any different after he got shot. He just had a very dry sense of humor. One day a young girl came up to him, looked at his face, and asked, "What happened to you?" He bent down and said in a very serious voice, "Never run with scissors." Dry, droll, and a heart of gold. You couldn't help but love him. We were all prepared to hate his girlfriend. We were sure she'd leave him after he was torn up, but she stood by him. He finally proposed, and we were all happy about it. She is one awesome lady. If there is a poster child for overcoming disabilities, Ryan was it. After the injury, he went to college, graduated with honors, and had an excellent job waiting for him. He climbed Mount Hood, Mount Rainier, and a bunch of other mountains. He went hunting and shot a prize trophy elk with the help of a spotter and a gun with some badass technology. He competed in a triathlon. I remember one night Ryan said that he was glad it was he who got shot instead of any of the other guys. Sure, he was angry at first, but he felt he was at peace and living a full life. He felt he could handle it and be happy no matter what. He was right. When I think about the patriotism that drives SEALs, I am reminded of Ryan recovering in a hospital in Bethesda, Maryland. There he was, freshly wounded, almost fatally, and blind for life. Many reconstructive surgeries to his face loomed ahead. You know what he asked for? He asked for someone to wheel him to a flag and give him some time. He sat in his wheelchair for close to a half hour, saluting as the American flag whipped in the wind. That's Ryan, a true patriot. A genuine warrior with a heart of gold. Of course, we all gave him shit and told him somebody probably wheeled him in front of a dumpster and just told him it was a flag. Being Ryan, he dished out as many blind jokes as he took and had us all rolling every time we talked. When he moved away, we would chat on the phone and get together whenever we could. In 2010, I found out he and his wife were expecting their first child. Meanwhile, the injuries he'd had in Iraq required further surgeries. He went into the hospital one morning. Later that afternoon, I got a call from Marcus Luttrell asking if I had heard about Ryan. "Yeah, I just talked to him yesterday," I told him. "He and his wife are having a baby. Isn't it great?" "He died just a little while ago," said Marcus, his voice quiet. Something had gone wrong at the hospital. It was a tragic end to a heroic life. I'm not sure any of us who knew him have gotten over it. I don't think I ever will. The baby was a beautiful girl. I'm sure her father's spirit lives on in her. Mighty warriors. After her son's death, Mark Lee's mom, Debbie, became almost a surrogate mother to the other members of our platoon. A very courageous woman, she has dedicated herself to helping other warriors as they have made the transition from the battlefield. She's now president of America's Mighty Warriors, www.americasmightywarriors.org, and has done a lot personally for veterans through what she calls random acts of kindness, inspired by Mark's life and a letter he wrote to her before he passed away. There's nothing random about Debbie. She's a dedicated and hard-working woman, as devoted to her cause as Mark was to his. Before he died, Mark wrote an incredible letter home. Available at the site, it told a moving story about some of the things he saw in Iraq, a terrible hospital, ignorant and despicable people. But it was also an extremely positive letter, full of hope and encouraging all of us to do some small part for others. To my mind, though, whatever he wrote home doesn't adequately describe the Mark we all knew. There was a lot more to him. He was a real tough guy with a great sense of humor. He was a gung-ho warrior and a great friend. He had unshakable faith in God and loved his wife with might. Heaven is surely a better place because he's there, but Earth has lost one of its best. Craft. Deciding to leave the Navy was hard enough, but now I was going to be out of a job. It was time to figure out what to do with the rest of my life. I had a number of options and possibilities. I'd been talking with a friend of mine named Mark Spicer about starting a sniper school in the States. After 25 years in the British Army, Mark retired as a sergeant major. He was one of the foremost snipers in their army, and had served over 20 years as a sniper and sniper platoon commander. Mark has written 3 books on sniping and is one of the world's leading experts on the subject. We both realized there was and is a need for certain types of very specific training for military and police units. No one was providing the sort of hands-on instruction that would help prepare their personnel for the different situations they might find. With our experience, we knew we could tailor courses and provide enough range time to make a difference. The problem was getting everything together to do it. Money, of course, was a pretty big consideration. Then, partly by chance, I happened to meet someone who realized the company could be a good investment and who also had faith in me, J. Kyle Bass. Kyle had made a lot of money investing, and when we met, he was looking for a bodyguard. I guess he figured, who better than a SEAL? But when we got talking and he asked where I saw myself in a few years, I told him about the school. He was intrigued, and rather than hiring me as his bodyguard, he helped provide the financing for our company. And just like that, Craft International was born. Actually, it wasn't just like that. We busted butt to get it going, working long hours and sweating out all the details the way any entrepreneurs do. 2 other guys joined Mark and me to form the ownership team, Beau French and Stephen Young. Their areas of expertise have more to do with the business side of things, but they're both knowledgeable about weapons and the tactics that we teach. Today, Craft International's corporate offices are in Texas. We have training sites in Texas and Arizona and work internationally on security measures and other special projects. Mark can occasionally be seen on the History Channel. He's pretty comfortable in front of the cameras, so at times he'll relax into a real thick British accent. The History Channel is kind enough to translate his thick accent into good old boy English with subtitles. We have yet to need subtitles for any Craft courses, but we haven't ruled out the possibility. We've assembled a team we believe is the best of the best in their given areas for all the areas of training we provide. You can find more information at www.craftinternational.com. That's C-R-A-F-T-I-N-T-L. Building a company involves a lot of different skills I didn't think I had. It also involves a ton of admin work. Damn. I don't mind hard work, even if it is at a desk. One of the pullbacks on this job is that it's given me Dell hand. I spend a lot of time pounding a computer keyboard. And every blue moon I have to wear a suit and tie. But otherwise, it's a perfect job for me. I may not be rich, but I enjoy what I do. The logo for Craft came from the Punisher symbol, with the Crusader crosshair and the right eye in honor of Ryan Jobe. He also inspired our company slogan. In April 2009, after Somali pirates had taken over a ship and were threatening the captain with death, SEAL snipers killed them from a nearby destroyer. Someone from the local media asked Ryan what he thought. "Despite what your mama told you," he quipped, "violence does solve problems." That seemed a pretty appropriate slogan for snipers, so it became ours. Back in Texas. I was still conflicted about leaving the Navy, but knowing that I was going to start Craft gave me more incentive. When the time finally came, I couldn't wait. After all, I was going back home. Was I in a hurry? I got out of the Navy November 4. On November 6, I was kicking Texas dust. While I was working on Craft International, my family stayed back in the San Diego area. The kids finishing up with school and Taya getting the house ready to sell. My wife planned to have everything wrapped up in January so we could reunite in Texas. They came out at Christmas. I'd been missing the kids and her terribly. I pulled her into the room at my parents' place and said, "What do you think about going back by yourself?" Leave the kids with me. She was tickled. She had a lot to do, and while she loved our children, taking care of them and getting the house ready to sell was exhausting. I loved having my son and daughter with me. I had a big assist from my parents who helped watch him during the week. Friday afternoons, I'd take the kids and we'd have daddy vacations for 3 and sometimes 4 days at a shot. People have an idea in their heads that fathers aren't able to spend comfortable time with very young children. I don't think that's true. Hell, I had as much fun as they did. We'd mess around on a trampoline and play ball for hours. We'd visit the zoo, hit the playgrounds, watch a movie. They'd help Dad grill. We all had a great time. When my daughter was a baby, it took a bit of time for her to warm up to me, but gradually she came to trust me more and got used to having me around. Now she is all about her daddy. Of course, she had him wrapped around her little finger from day one. I began teaching my son how to shoot when he was 2, starting with the basics of a BB rifle. My theory is that kids get into trouble because of curiosity. If you don't satisfy it, you're asking for big problems. If you inform them and carefully instruct them on safety when they're young, you avoid a lot of the trouble. My son has learned to respect weapons. I've always told him, if you want to use a gun, come get me. There's nothing I like better than shooting. He already has his own rifle, a .22 lever action, and he shoots pretty good groups with it. He's amazing with a pistol, too. My daughter is still a little young and hasn't shown as much interest yet. I suspect she will soon, but in any event, extensive firearms training will be mandatory before she is allowed to date, which should be around the time she turns 30. Both kids have gone out hunting with me. They're still a little young to focus for long periods of time, but I suspect they'll get the hang of it before too long. Taya, Chris and I have gone back and forth about how we would feel if our children went into the military. Of course, we don't want them to be hurt or for anything to happen to them, but there are a lot of positives to military service. We'll both be proud of them, no matter what they do. If my son was to consider going into SEALs, I would tell him to really think about it. I would tell him that he has to be prepared. I think it's horrible for family. If you go to war, it does change you, and you have to be prepared for that, too. I tell him to sit down and talk to his father about the reality of things. Sometimes I feel like crying just thinking about him in a firefight. I think Chris has done enough for the country so that we can skip a generation, but we'll both be proud of our children no matter what. Settling in Texas got me closer to my parents on a permanent basis. Since I've been back with them, they tell me some of the shell that I built up during the war has melted away. My father says that I closed off parts of myself. He believes they've come back, somewhat at least. I don't think you can train for years to kill, he admits, and expect all that to disappear overnight. Down in the depths. With all this good stuff going on, you'd think I was living a fairy tale or a perfect life, and maybe I should be. But real life doesn't travel in a perfect straight line. It doesn't necessarily have that all lived happily ever after bit. You have to work on where you're going. And just because I had a great family and an interesting job didn't mean things were perfect. I still felt bad about leaving the SEALs. I still resented my wife for presenting me with what felt like an ultimatum. So even though life should have been sweet, for some months after getting out of the service, it felt like it was plunging down a mine shaft. I started drinking a lot, pounding back beers. I'd say I went into a depression, feeling sorry for myself. Pretty soon drinking was all I did. After a while, it was hard liquor, and it was all through the day. I don't want to make this sound more dramatic than it really is. Other people have faced more difficult problems, but I was certainly headed in the wrong direction. I was going downhill and gathering speed. Then one night I turned a corner too fast in my truck. Now, maybe there were extenuating circumstances. Maybe the road was slippery or something else was out of whack. Or maybe that guardian angel that had saved me back in Ramadi decided to intervene. Whatever. All I know is I totaled my truck and came out without a scratch. On my body, my ego was something else again.
The accident woke me up. I'm sorry to say that I needed something like that to get my head back straight. I still drink beer, though not nearly to excess. I think I realize everything I have and everything I could lose. And I also understand not just where my responsibilities are, but how to fulfill them. Giving back. I'm starting to understand the contributions I can make to others. I realize that I can be a complete man, taking care of my family and helping in a small way to take care of others. Marcus Luttrell started an organization called Lone Survivor Foundation to get some of our wounded warriors out of the hospital and into situations where they can enjoy themselves a little. After being wounded in Afghanistan, Marcus said he healed twice as fast at his mom's ranch than he had in the hospital. Something about the open air and being able to roam around naturally helped the process. That's one of the inspirations for his foundation, and it's become one of my guiding principles as I try to do my small share. I've gotten together with some people I know around Texas who have ranches and asked if they could donate their places for a few days at a time. They've been more than generous. We've had small groups of servicemen disabled in the war come in and spend time there hunting, shooting guns on a range, or just hanging out. The idea is to have a good time. I should mention that my friend Kyle, the same guy who was a driving force behind getting Kraft afloat, is also extremely patriotic and supportive of the troops. He graciously allows us to use his beautiful barefoot ranch for many of our retreats for the wounded troops. Rick Kell and David Faraday's organization, Troops First, also works with Kraft to help as many wounded guys as we can. Hell, I've had a bunch of fun myself. We go hunting a couple of times a day, shoot a few rounds on the range, then at night trade stories and beers. It's not so much the war stories as the funny stories that you remember. Those are the ones that affect you. They underline the resilience of these guys. They were warriors in the war, and they take that same warrior attitude into dealing with their disabilities. As you'd expect if I'm involved, there's a lot of busting going on back and forth, giving each other hell. I don't always get the last laugh, but I do take my shots. The first time I had some of them out to one of the ranches, I took them out on the back porch before we started shooting and gave them a little orientation. "All right," I told them, picking up my rifle. "Since none of you are SEALs, I better give you some background. This here is a trigger." "Screw you, Squid," they shouted, and we had a good old time from there on out, pushing each other and making fun. What wounded veterans don't need is sympathy. They need to be treated like the men they are, equals, heroes, and people who still have tremendous value for society. If you want to help them, start there. In a funny way, busting back and forth shows more respect than asking, "Are you okay?" in a sickly sweet voice. We've only just begun, but we've had good enough success that the hospitals are very cooperative. We've been able to expand the program to include couples. We're aiming to do maybe 2 retreats a month going forward. Our work has gotten me thinking bigger and bigger. I wouldn't mind doing a reality hunting show with these guys. I think it could inspire a lot of other Americans to really give back to their veterans and their present military families. Helping each other out, that's America. I think America does a lot to support people. That's great for those truly in need. But I also think we create dependency by giving money to those who don't want to work, both in other countries and our own. Help people help themselves. That's the way it should be. I'd like us to remember the suffering of those Americans who were injured serving this country before we dole out millions to slackers and moochers. Look at the homeless. A lot are vets. I think we owe them more than just our gratitude. They were willing to sign a blank check for America, with the cost right up to their life. If they were willing to do that, why shouldn't we be taking care of them? I'm not suggesting we give vets handouts. What people need are hand-ups, a little opportunity and strategic help. One of the wounded vets I met at the ranch retreats has an idea to help homeless vets by helping build or renovate housing. I think it's a great idea. Maybe this house won't be where they live forever, but it'll get them going. Jobs, training,
there's an enormous amount that we can do. I know some people will say that you'll have a bunch just taking advantage, but you deal with that. You don't let it ruin things for everyone. There's no reason someone who has fought for their country should be homeless or jobless. Who I am. It's taken a while, but I have gotten to the point where being a SEAL no longer defines me. I need to be a husband and a father. Those things, now, are my first calling. Being a SEAL has been a huge part of me. I still feel the pull. I certainly would have preferred having the best of both worlds, the job and the family, but at least in my case, the job wouldn't allow it. I'm not sure I would have either. In a sense, I had to step away from the job to become the fuller man my family needed me to be. I don't know where or when the change came. It didn't happen until I got out. I had to get through that resentment at first. I had to move through the good things and the bad things to reach a point where I could really move ahead. Now I want to be a good dad and a good husband. Now I've rediscovered a real love for my wife. I genuinely miss her when I'm on a business trip. I want to be able to hug her and sleep next to her. Taya. What I loved about Chris in the beginning was the way he unabashedly wore his heart on his sleeve. He didn't play games with my heart or my head. He was a straight shooter who seemed to back up his feelings and actions, spending an hour and a half to drive up to see me, then leaving in time for work at 5 a.m. Communicating, putting up with my moods. His sense of fun balanced out my serious side and brought out the youthful side in me. He was up for anything and completely supportive of anything I wanted or dreamed of. He got along famously with my family, and I did with his. When our marriage reached a crisis, I said I wouldn't love him the same if he reenlisted again. It wasn't that I didn't love him, but I felt that his decision would confirm what I thought was becoming increasingly evident. In the beginning, I believed he loved me more than anything. Slowly, the team started to become his first love. He continued to say the words and tell me what he felt I needed to hear and what he had always said in the past to express his love. The difference is, the words and actions were no longer meshing. He still loved me, but it was different. He was consumed by the teams. When he was away, he would tell me things like, "I would do anything to be home with you," and "I miss you," and "You are the most important thing in the world to me." I knew if he joined up again that all of what he had been telling me over those past years were mostly words or feelings in theory rather than feelings expressed in actions. How could I love with the same reckless abandon if I knew I was not what he said I was? I was second fiddle at best. He would die for strangers and country. My challenges and pain seemed to be mine alone. He wanted to live his life and have a happy wife to come home to. At the time, it meant everything I loved in the beginning was changing, and I would have to love him differently. I thought it might be less, but it turns out it was just different. Just like in any relationship, things changed. We changed. We both made mistakes, and we both learned a lot. Maybe we love each other differently, but maybe that is a good thing. Maybe it is more forgiving and more mature, or maybe it is just different. It is still really good. We still have each other's backs, and we've learned that even through the tough times, we don't want to lose each other or the family we've built. The more time that goes by, the more we are each able to show each other love in ways that the other one understands and feels. I feel like my love for my wife has gotten deeper over the past few years. Taya bought me a new wedding ring made of tungsten steel. I don't think it's a coincidence that it's the hardest metal she could find. It has crusader crosses on it, too. She jokes that it's because marriage is like a crusade. Maybe for us it has been. Taya. I feel something coming from him that I hadn't felt before. He's definitely not the person he was before the war, but there are a lot of the same qualities. His sense of humor, his kindness, his warmth, his courage and a sense of responsibility, his quiet confidence inspires me. Like any couple, we still have our day-to-day life things we have to work through, but most importantly, I feel loved, and I feel the kids and I are important. War. I'm not the same guy I was when I first went to war. No one is. Before you're in combat, you have this innocence about you. Then, all of a sudden, you see this whole other side of life. I don't regret any of it. I'd do it again. At the same time, war definitely changes you. You embrace death. As a SEAL, you go to the dark side. You're immersed in it, continually going to war. You gravitate to the blackest parts of existence. Your psyche builds up its defenses. That's why you laugh at gruesome things like heads being blown apart, and worse. Growing up, I wanted to be military, but I wondered, how would I feel about killing someone? Now I know. It's no big deal. I did it a lot more than I'd ever thought I would, or for that matter, more than any American sniper before me. But I also witnessed the evil my targets committed and wanted to commit, and by killing them, I protected the lives of many fellow soldiers. I don't spend a lot of time philosophizing about killing people. I have a clear conscience about my role in the war. I am a strong Christian, not a perfect one, not close, but I strongly believe in God, Jesus, and the Bible. When I die, God is going to hold me accountable for everything I've done on earth. He may hold me back until last and run everybody else through the line because it will take so long to go over all my sins. Mr. Kyle, let's go into the back room. Honestly, I don't know what will really happen on Judgment Day, but what I lean toward is that you know all of your sins, and God knows them all, and shame comes over you at the reality that He knows. I believe the fact that I've accepted Jesus as my Savior will be my salvation. But in that back room, or whatever it is when God confronts me with my sins, I do not believe any of the kills I had during the war will be among them. Everyone I shot was evil. I had good cause on every shot. They all deserve to die. My regrets are about the people I couldn't save. Marines, soldiers, my buddies. I still feel their loss. I still ache for my failure to protect them. I'm not naive, and I'm beyond romanticizing war and what I had to do there. The worst moments of my life have come as a SEAL, losing my buddies, having a kid die on me. I'm sure some of the things I went through pale in comparison to what some of the guys went through in World War II and other conflicts. On top of all the shit they went through in Vietnam, they had to come home to a country that spat on them. When people ask me how the war changed me, I tell them that the biggest thing has to do with my perspective. You know all the everyday things that stress you here? I don't give a shit about them. There are bigger and worse things that could happen than to have this little tiny problem wreck your life, or even your day. I've seen them. More, I've lived them. This is John Pruden.
Alrighty. All done. All done. Moochers, slackers out there, if you have any final commentary you want to get in on Mr. Kyle, the number to dial is 760-569-7676. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 760-569-7676. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Final commentary on American Sniper. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. feel free to chime in.
Greetings. Once again, incredible. Incredible. Heard some noise in the background. Incredible the behavior of this person. There's a friend of mine who has this idea that people who classify themselves as white actually are not people, that they are of a separate species from people. And if there is any example of that, I would say Chris Kyle is probably one of them, one of these examples that this friend of mine speaks about. I also, through the reading of the book, examined the comments made by the wife. It seems that their relationship has its stress levels, but one thing that white people have in common, and they're experts at it, is that they have a code. They do have a code. It's a racist one, but nevertheless, they have a code. And I think that probably is the tie that binds when it comes to a lot of their relationships. Quote unquote being together when it's time to be together. And those are just some of my observations from the last reading. And about the book itself, back to the central figure, incredible as far as whatever someone identifies as the meaning of human, the exact opposite. The exact opposite. And hopefully this doesn't be incorrect in my thoughts, but I just have to be honest. I'm kind of glad that he's dead. And I'll give it to the next person.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How you doing? I love to hear Mr. DeMario. He did a great job. He said it all. His friend said it good, too. These people are not human. They're mankind, some creation. Something went wrong. This book was excellent. I'm glad it's over, though, but it was excellent. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about white pathology. Devout Christian. You know, the religion, slave masters gave the slaves that kept the slaves waiting for the white savior and forgiving the slave master for what they did. And then again, the slave master could go to the same God and be forgiven for what he did to the slaves. It's, you know, I could go kill 100-something Iraqis, and it's all good. I mean, I asked Jesus to forgive me, and it's all done with. And that's it. I mean, just their pathology altogether. Anytime I hear whites talk about that, any rhetoric about people getting free handouts, they're not deserving it. You know, I know they're talking about black people. I don't even have to second guess it. I don't think they mind all the whites that get free handouts. I also like to say, we always say, you say it all the time, Gus, you know, we don't have access to loans. And here this guy just goes off, says, I'm a sale. I'm sure he said, hey, I'm the legend. I killed about 200, 300 Iraqis. And this guy said, man, I'm going to give you a loan. You could get a loan. We're going to start a company. And that was that. Had a few observations. I watched the movie. with Tom Hanks and the Somali pirates. And in the movie, I mentioned it because they also had the SEALs coming at the end and they were sniping, and it made me think of Chris Kyle. And the way they depict the Somalis in that movie is how they depicted Arab terrorists in the movies from the era when I grew up, you know, the 80s, 90s, you know, like movies like The Siege and True Lies and many more. Like, they're these emotional, radical, and most importantly, they're stupid. They're not smart. They're always arguing with each other. You know, it's almost comical to watch them. And that's the way they're doing the Somalis. And I'm glad they didn't come out with a whole bunch of movies like this. I know that it's still early, but, you know, usually when they start doing that in movies, that means that's the place they're going. They're just desensitizing the U.S. public to those people, so they feel like they're worthless and they deserve whatever they get anyway. And also, from watching the movies, I had to keep in mind that, you know, they keep depicting these Somali guys as dumb and, you know, not coordinated and arguing with each other. But the Somalis, if I recall, was the ones that took down the Blackhawks and pretty much defeated the U.S. Army. You know, they had to call in for reinforcements. Lastly, I thought it related because it's the same region of the world. I'm looking at the Jordan situation with this fighting now, this CIA, you know, Mossad, MI6 created smokescreen, formerly known as Al-Qaeda, now known as ISIS. And who knew Jordan had warplanes with missiles and cameras on them? I was looking at this at work on the news, like, oh my God, like, they got the U.S. stuff. They had, I would like to know who's manning their satellite-guided missiles. I mean, who's doing this? I mean, this is Jordan. And, you know, I'm looking at it with shock with all the stuff they got, but I'm also appalled. Because if they had all these military capabilities to fight these other Arabians, ISIS, a military that the American-trained Iraqis and the Russian-trained Syrians can't seem to handle, then why don't they ever do anything with Israel bombs Palestine? I mean, it's like, man, what kind of, I didn't know y'all had all this stuff. I mean, y'all could probably stage a war. If you had all these military weapons, I mean, that you've been storing, that you can now go and bomb people with missile-guided missiles, I mean, laser-guided missiles and all this, I was just shocked. And that's all I had to add.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir. That is actually Mr. Demery. The first male caller was not Mr. Demery, but we can hear you, sir.
Yes. Just like
I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry.
No problem. But just like a finely written fairy tale, this book kind of winds up in a nice, little neat way. He gets out of the service, and he's got a loan waiting on him, like the last caller said, get him started on his life. And, you know, now he wants to give back, you know, start a something similar to the foundation that Marcus Luttrell had started. You know, all this just makes out a round person that gives you an image of deception, of who this person really is. We have to remember that this is the same guy that wanted the two-year-old to look him straight in the eye, and then we learned that he's teaching his two-year-old to shoot a BB gun, and later he said the two-year-old, I believe, owns a .22 rifle, lever action. So the pathology continues. And it's in the wording when he says, as a SEAL, you go to the dark side and you gravitate to the blackest part of existence. All these references to dark and black in a negative sense, it's not a coincidence. When a killer laughs at gruesome things like heads being blown apart or worse. And I ask you, what could be worse than your head being blown apart? And last but not least, God is going to take this guy into the back room. Come on, man. I mute my line.
Any of the other folks who dialed in, who had a hand up, any comments they wanted to get in as we wrap up American Sniper? We'll let Karma finish and then we'll get you, sir.
I'll make it quick. I would read, I don't know if you guys read Bloods already. It's the black veterans in their histories in the Vietnam War. Did y'all read that already? I don't know. Anyway, I would read that so that I could stay a little bit grounded because, you know, it's just, I feel like I was just flying off into space with this crazy book. You know, you don't think any of that could possibly be true, but the one thing in life you must remember is you need to believe people when they tell you who they are the first time they tell you who they are. Don't say, oh, that can't possibly be true. As crazy as this sounds, on some level, we need to be believing it. Because I had to find that one passage about the soldier. In the Vietnam War, he says, oh, yeah, this guy from Kentucky, first time he met black people, he seemed like he was an all right kind of white guy. You know, he was okay. He said the only thing he really hated was leaving his sheep. Because he said how he used to cut a stump and then put the sheep across the stump, and then he would rape the sheep, and he said he really missed doing that a lot when he was in the war. So, you know, as crazy as some of this sounds, you know, it may fantastically be true, maybe. I'm in my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I believe the words that he mentioned at the very end, that pretty much summed up racism, white supremacy, pretty much some of the things he said. These are not verbatim, but he said pretty much the kills that he committed, the murders that he killed during the war didn't count, that the people that he murdered deserved to die, and pretty much once he started killing was no big deal. And I pretty much think that that's how racism, white supremacy deals with particularly black people, you know, pretty much all not white people, but black people in particular. So if, you know, one of us happens to get murdered during the war that they're waging on us, it doesn't count, you know, when that judgment day, that quote-unquote judgment day comes, that you getting murdered, you know, during this war, it doesn't count. And just the way that they related the Christianity and the religion, particularly at the end as well. So I guess he said during judgment day that, you know, pretty much he doesn't know what's going to happen, but he pretty much feels that all the killing that he did during the war was going to be excused by, you know, the Almighty, you know. So, and I think that's how generally racists think about non-white people, again, particularly black people. And also they wanted to, you know, put icing on the cake, so to speak, or they wanted to really reiterate his, I guess his return to, I don't know, humanity, so to speak. And they showed how he was relating to his kids and how loving and caring he really was, just to, I guess, kind of to curb the, you know, all the killing that he committed, you know, during the war, that, you know, he's still a human and a nice, you know, white person at heart. And they just really wanted to top it off with that as well. But I think he summed it up at the end pretty much. And that sums up racism, white supremacy. And that's all I wanted to share. Thank you.
anybody who has not shared yet have a hand up, anything that they wanted to get in before we conclude American Sniper? If you have a hand up, your line should be open.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I just wanted to say I'm so glad this book is over. I did not enjoy this at all. I had a conversation with a white person today who literally thinks that Chris Kyle is his hero, and it just goes to show how this person can tell his story and people can relate and hold him with such honor and reverence. And that's kind of scary because, I mean, I really was just appalled, especially because I read the book and this person saw the movie. But just to know that they are looking at him as a hero is just sickening, in my opinion. And I'm just glad that the book is over, and I'll be looking forward to the next book. But I didn't enjoy this at all. It just really just showed white supremacy at its finest and just the joy that they get out of killing. And that's just not something that is exciting to me. So I just wanted to say, I'm glad it's over. That's all. I just wanted to put that in. Thanks.
Right on. Anyone else? Comments they want to make sure they get in before we call it a done deal with American Sniper? Anybody else got a hand up who didn't get a chance to comment yet? We got everybody? Nobody?
Yeah, can I be heard?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I at the end part there, I heard Taya, and I think him too, saying that how much he changed since he's been in the military. And I'm just wondering, I'm like, to me, you haven't changed at all. You were the person that you've always been. Why do you guys keep emphasizing like there's some kind of change? And he had made a comment about some people not being comfortable being around young children. And I think he was talking about himself because he wasn't comfortable being around his son when he was born. Yeah, I mean, as everybody else says, I mean, he's just a psychopath, you know, just the white, you know, the white psyche on display. They are silly on display, you know. Kill, 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 you know, abuse, victimize, and also be a victim while victimizing, you know. Yeah, that's all I have to say.
Anybody else? We didn't miss anyone who didn't get a chance to share yet.
And I wanted to say, as horrible as it was, a book, I am reading it, and I'm finishing up with the teenagers in my house. They're getting close to going off to the university, so I was glad to discover the cows, and then I share information with them. I'm trying to get them, you know, prepared. We live in an area where it's mostly white, and so I'm just trying to get them prepared. So I agree with the caller. It was kind of, you know, you want to grit your teeth listening to it because it was just, I feel like it's good constructive information. Got some teenagers out there, maybe some young adults. Just so they can get, you know, the mindset of the European. And that's all I have.
Definitely agree there. I told one of our investors that this is a book that I probably would not have read, definitely would not have read, and probably wouldn't have wanted to see the film either prior to recognizing and getting a better grasp of what white supremacy is and how it works. But I think if you're using it for those study purposes,
to kind of investigate what it means to be white. I think this book offers a lot. Just some of the concluding comments. He said that at the kind of wrap-up point, he said, since he's been in combat and done all his tours, that when he comes back and is a civilian, that the things that used to bother him don't bother him as much anymore. And that is just a bold-faced lie. He said in the session we did 2 weeks ago that he would come back and get in traffic in California, and he would want to snatch a motorist out the car and beat their brains in. Like, he just said that, like, two weeks ago. Not to mention his performance at the hospital when his child was being born and how aggravated he was. And he said he just couldn't deal with that situation. Or even being a father, this same guy who's running around his own house when the alarm went off because of him. And he's running around the house talking about how he just couldn't function. He had to be by himself. So I feel like that is a total lie. I also felt that, again, when he's talking about his quote unquote guardian angel looking out for him, and he has this vehicle accident where he totals the car, but, you know, he survives unscathed. In my opinion, that's just, you're a drunk driver. You're an alcoholic who, that's all you've talked about, the bulk of the book. What was it, buffalo urine from the chapter way, way back where he had his white guys from Poland and they're drinking liquor and running around being soldiers trying to kill folks. I mean, that's what he's talked about all book long. Shooting, killing people, getting drunk, going to the bar, beating up folks, getting rent. I suspect it's very likely he could have been under the influence. He said this happened at the time when he was drinking all day long and drinking hard liquor, but he doesn't get presented as an alcoholic and a felon, someone who should be arrested, not a fine, upstanding citizen and a veteran. It's not presented in that manner. I also thought the sequence at the end, I think folks touched on that in terms of him saying as a Navy SEAL, you go to the blackest place, the darkest place. I mean, all of that symbolism. You're going to these black and dark places to kill non-white people. Even the reference to Black Hawk Down, I thought that was significant. I think that had been pointed out before in terms of the importance. I think that was one of the movies that they even watched, I think, back when he was in Buds, Black Hawk Down. Josh Wickett wrote a film review of that, which I thought was excellent as well, Black Hawk Down. I also thought at the end, this is more of the Hollywood ending. I think the last, I don't know if you want to call it chapter or sub-segment, the last few subheadings of chapter 14, I think that's more in line with what you get in the movie. My opinion of the film is that you get like a good two-hour dose of that, as opposed to all of his other narcissistic and psychopathic behavior. It's more of this, oh, this is a God-fearing man, and I just want to do the best for my country and my family and love being around you guys. And you know, this is just wonderful. I think the film does a really, from the racist perspective, just does a phenomenal job of pitching out that myth. I'm not surprised. Any white person that comes up and says that they love the film, this guy was a hero, they didn't, even if they read the book, it wouldn't surprise me. But definitely, if they're just going off of, I didn't read the book, I just went to the movies, absolutely. This is going to be the greatest white man in the history of the universe, next to white Jesus. This guy, I mean, wow. I'm sure it's going to be tons of folks named after him and have the book on display in their home, even if they didn't read it, as some sort of trophy piece. And as I think has been said all along, a great enlistment tool to get more whites and non-whites as a result of this film to be willing to go and get suited and booted and go out and kill non-white people for the U.S. military. The Moocher point, absolutely. It even reminded me of the G.I. Bill. I think we talked about that before because he mentioned World War II and Vietnam. The G.I. Bill, for folks who served in World War II, most black people could not take advantage of that because of economic white terrorism. That came to mind. And even I think Mr. Reed had brought this up before, this mythology that soldiers are coming back and being spent on. I do not think that that is accurate. You certainly had a large segment of the population that was vociferously opposed to the Vietnam conflict. But I think that's been brought up repeatedly, that this narrative about returning veterans being spat on, that just wasn't the case. I'm sure that they were booed at and people said whatever, but people were not spitting on them, at least the reports that I've been told, that that's just another part of this mythology and the way that this gets talked about, an event from 50 years ago. Let's see, anything else that I think is important? Oh, the portion where he's reading about Ryan, who, you know, gets injured, he's blinded, he still has a child, and then he dies. I thought maybe, you know, I missed up, it wasn't the best audio for the live version, but I thought it sounded like the narrator's voice was choking up, as though he was trying to make it seem like he was, you know, seconds from bursting into tears. Talking about this dead white guy, and I was just like, wow, like, you all are laying it on mighty thick here. we've done a lot of audiobooks at this point. I don't think I've, with all of the terrorism that we've heard about, Madiba and what happened in South Africa and the Little Rock Nine and them being terrorized and bombs being set off at black people's houses, I don't think I have ever heard a narrator in an audiobook go into quivering and trembling as though they are about to be in need of some Kleenex. That is brand new and super Hollywood on a whole lot of levels. I think, and just the religion of white supremacy, I thought that symbolic. He gets a new wedding band with all these crosses, and even thinking of marriage as a crusade. Oh, and just with the homoeroticism, he made a point of saying that he had to, quote unquote, remember what it was like to be in love with his white wife and presumably his white children. He repeatedly, unabashedly, proudly announces his love for other white men that he is killing with throughout the book. I just find that amazing, that it's almost second nature. I don't need no counseling. I don't need no refresher course. I don't need to think about it. We don't need to have no talks. If you are a white man and we are at war going out and killing these savages, niggers, hey, I love you, man. You are out here helping me blow these folks up and kill these folks. I love you. My wife that I'm having a child with, might need manual little counseling, refresher course for me, just further illustration of what is important for whites. Terrorizing, the practice, the business, the religion of white supremacy is number one. Everything else is way, 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 way back. Distant third, fourth, fifth, whatever you want to call it. And the last comment I'll get in, the Nick Irving, that miniseries project, the Weinstein Company is producing that. That's the same production film company that gave us Inglourious Basterds that was referenced earlier, as well as Django Unchained. I don't know if Quentin Tarantino will be called in to put Mr. Irving's project together, but That came out on February 6th, Chris Kyle Day, February 2nd, that came out, that the Weinstein Company plans a 5-part sniper miniseries with Mr. Nick Irving, who was a sniper with the U.S. Army 3rd Ranger Battalion, not a Navy SEAL. With that, any quick final sentence anyone need to get in before we wrap up?
Yes, right quick. I did notice the contrast when this person, this killer, was evoking Christianity and all of the killing and how he justifies all of the killing. That's been a subject presently, a very popular subject with ISIS and the critique primarily from white people about their means of waging war is, you know, with religion, the religion of Islam. It's a contrast. And I believe Mr. Obama spoke of similarities. I don't know if it was today or yesterday or within the last 72 hours, from my understanding. He mentioned about the contradictions when people speak about atrocities. Well, Christianity, which is, to me, is code for white people primarily, what he was speaking on. That's why he's probably in a lot of trouble right now. Nick mentions about the contrast between, well, Christianity had his people who twist, quote unquote, Christianity, also had their atrocities from the Crusades. He also mentioned up very present, talking about the slavery, and he mentioned, I think, something about the incidents that took place 50 years ago, what is called the Civil Rights Movement, and the people who was enacting these atrocities identified themselves as Christians. I'm quote unquote not a Christian. I don't call myself a Christian, but if there was a non-white person a black person that called themselves Christians, I know by reading this book and learning something about this person, they would at least be somewhat, I don't know if you want to say embarrassed by it, but I mean, it would be like, whoa, you know, this guy evoking Christianity to justify what he did with his life, you know, and his thoughts, you know, it's incredible. Like I say, it's incredible. That's it.
Such is white supremacy.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. that's really the religion that he was practicing, to tell you the truth.
Amen. You
know, not Christianity.
Amen.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am, if you can make it concise.
Yeah, very, very concise. I'm sorry to wait for a little bit, so I don't know if you mentioned this, but that little closing remark you made about being a Christian. And it was just so arrogant and so self-centered. And, you know, I sent you the scripture from Matthew, and it says, it's Jesus saying, talking about these people that, you know, claim to be Christians, basically, but they're not. You can tell by their behavior because they don't follow what he wants them to do. All that killing and being proud of killing, the whole thing just disgusting to me, that man. So that's kind of all I want to say.
Mm.
Yes, ma'am.
I've heard it said before, everyone talking about being a Christian is not going to heaven. If you believe in all of that, I will say, if this narrative unfolds as he laid out in the book, the quote unquote judgment day will arrive and the creator will have Chris Kyle at the what they call pearly gates. I cannot imagine a figure like Dr. Martin Luther King being there and Chris Kyle and both of them saying, well, I'm a Christian and you can look at my record of conduct as a Christian on planet Earth. I know if I'm in that line, the creator is going to have some explaining to do if both of these folks are Christian, according to their body of work. But it will all be explained in the by, so I have been told. We should be back tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Workplace racism, obviously, as well as news notes from the past 7 days. I was kind of done with the Super Bowl because that certainly cannot be the most important problem pressing black people currently. But I wrote a blog post Sunday night after the Super Bowl, or Monday morning, however you want to phrase it, and it went kind of viral in a very short period of time. It might even be study worthy to go check out the comments. You can skip, I mean, whatever, if you read the article or not, but the comments, lots of white people felt the need to come and articulate their opposition to my my view on what happened at the Super Bowl, which I did not watch. But it has been fascinating just to watch, like just reading the comments and seeing it spread so rapidly in such a short period of time. So I guess a word might have to be said about all of that tomorrow, and what folks have heard, what folks have seen over the past 5 days, but certainly within context, because that is just not even close to being the most important problem facing black folks on the planet. But we'll be here tomorrow. We should have quite a few programs next week as well. If you get confused, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have questions, suggestions, gripes, complaints, feel free. We're also on Twitter @UntilJustice. I can also say, for the record, the next book for the study session, we'll be doing the autobiography of Malcolm X.
There had been a lot of folks that I'd spoken with.
Wow.
Years,
yay.
Not really.
Right on.
That book yet. And,
yay, I love that book.
I was a little bit surprised that there were so many listeners who had not read that book in its entirety. And since this is the 50-year anniversary of his assassination, I thought it would be fitting time to go back.
Great comeback.
Study and a nice balance out for what we have sat through for the past month and a half. But that's what we'll be starting up next Friday. I assume nobody should have too much of a problem getting their hands on a hard copy if you want to follow along. I think there are PDFs online available that you can nab as well, but that's what we'll be starting up next Friday. If I had my druthers, we would follow this with Wisdom of Psychopaths, because I think that would be a much better match for what we just heard and putting it in perspective. But given the anniversary coming up, I thought that would be a better choice. So that's next book, Autobiography of Malcolm X. You can take the next week to get your book or whatever preparation you need. Mm-hmm. Thank you kindly for tuning in. We will catch you guys in about 24 hours. Be safe, be sober. Unlike Chris Kyle, I don't think you're going to be able to go out and bar fight and brawl and wreck your car and not have any arrest record or damage as a result of. So again, under the system of white supremacy, sobriety would be best. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us maintain patience with other black people. We ask that you help us maintain patience with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.